Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you today from the mothership. Glad you've joined us. We've got a great show. Ash Scow from Real Clear Investigations going to be with us in studio here later on in the hour. Also, Pete Brownell, NRA president, will be with us on the program next hour. Brand new piece in the latest edition of America's First Freedom, The Only Way to Stop the Decline of Hunting. And we'll talk with Pete Brownell about this next hour. Also next hour, Alicia Schoetz James. She is the founder of 10-4 Clothing, which is a line of concealed carry clothing for women. And we'll be talking with Alicia coming up here about 3:40 Eastern time. Also, in hour three, our friend Stan Hayes with Operation Barbecue Relief. Now, listen, I know you might not think too fondly of CNN. I get it. But you should think fondly of Stan Hayes. And CNN has named Operation Barbecue Relief one of their top 10 CNN heroes. They need your votes. Operation Barbecue Relief, we met these guys a couple years ago. We were down in the Dallas, Texas area for a Mercury One charity event, and Operation Barbecue Relief was actually cooking up some barbecue there. So we started talking with Stan and learned their story. This is an organization that came together after the tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri a few years ago. And these were just a bunch of competitive barbecuers who got together and started feeding the people of Joplin, Missouri. And they stayed there for weeks, and they fed tens of thousands of people. And they thought, you know, there's something to this. And so now when a disaster unfolds all across this country, you know that there are likely to be volunteers from Operation Barbecue Relief showing up shortly thereafter. And again, providing food for people who have lost their homes, first responders, people who, you know, don't really have time to stop what they're doing and run out and go pick up lunch or dinner. And they will stay there until the need for them to be there is no longer present. They will be there for weeks on end, if need be. So we'll talk with Stan Hayes coming up in Hour 3. Kurt Schlichter from Town Hall joining us in Hour 3 as well. All right, so we're 5 days away from Election Day in Virginia. And I kind of thought that we maybe had reached bottom with that Latino Victory Fund ad that aired, however briefly, in the state of Virginia, showing the black pickup truck with the Gadsden license plate. Yeah, let's go ahead and play the ad. Why the heck not? Let's get my blood going here early on in the program. This was the ad by the Latino Victory Fund. Ran up until the terror attack in New York. And then the Latino Victory Fund pulled the ad. You can go ahead and play it. I'll just talk over because there's a lot of silence. So this ad was briefly on the air. It was pulled. Now, the Republican Governors Association today noting that an in-kind, actually a couple of in-kind contributions from the Latino Victory Fund made to the Ralph Northam campaign in the days before this ad appeared, which is not great news for Ralph Northam, who has weaselly denounced, I won't even say he's denounced the ad. He said, I would not have run this ad. But it looks like there certainly was an in-kind contribution to the Northam campaign from the group that put together this ad just days before it went on the air.
Is this what Donald Trump and Ed Gillespie mean by the American dream? Latino Victory Fund paid for and is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Reject hate. Vote November the 7th, and don't vote for the guy with the, followers and supporters who drive around trying to run over immigrant children, right? So the ad went off the air, and I, again, kind of thought maybe that was hitting bottom, and maybe it would start to rebound in the final days of the election. Apparently not. Tweet by Fanine Naropal, covering regional politics for the Washington Post. He was in Arlington, Virginia, not far from we are, here in the mothership last night, hearing State Senator Barbara Favola addressing a packed hall of Arlington Democrats, said they're evil, We're the good guys. The evil ones are the Virginia Republicans. They're evil. They're evil. Now listen, I don't know about you. I do believe that there is evil in this world. I do. I think it has been on display all around the globe, including here in the United States. But I don't believe that you can look at one political party, that you could look at one state, one religion, one philosophy, and declare they're evil. Those millions of people out there, they're evil and we're good. And yet that is, again, the apocalyptic language used by Virginia State Senator Barbara Favola trying to increase the turnout for this election. And apparently nothing's out of bounds to try to gin up support and gin up the rage and get out the vote. Because you're not just casting a vote, you are vanquishing evil, according to Senator Favola. So Finnit Naropil of the Washington Post asked Ralph Northam about this. And he said, quote, "I think people know my reputation. I've been in public service now for 10 years in Richmond. I believe in bringing people from both sides of the aisle to the table, doing things the Virginia way. We can agree to disagree, but in the end of the day, we need to do what's best for Virginia. That's what I've done for the past 10 years. That's what I'll do for the next 4 years as your governor." So they're not evil? I stand by my statement. So you can't even say they're not evil. You want to bring people together. I believe in, bringing people from both sides of the aisle to the table, doing things the Virginia way, but I'm not going to say they're not evil. 5 days left, Cameron. How low can we go?
I shudder to think. I don't know. And remember the day of the spot, the Northam's campaign spokesperson said, they didn't denounce the ad then. They said, nope. This is what the Republican Party in Virginia hath wrought, and they stood by the ad.
Yep. So, interestingly enough, there's an editorial in the Roanoke Times today. Why the Latino Victory Fund ad is so damaging. They say, we are not Republicans, the editorial board of the Roanoke Times, but we don't like what we see. We'll explain why. Talking about that Latino Victory Fund ad. First, they say it's factually wrong. No small thing. The ad suggests that the Gillespie supporters are racist vigilantes who want to run down minority kids. Really? The editorial board of the Roanoke Times writes, really? Secondly, the ad doesn't target the candidate, but rather his supporters. That seems akin to Hillary Clinton's comments about many supporters of Donald Trump being a basket of deplorables. Now, the Roanoke Times, no Republicans, mind you, say her comment was misinterpreted. She went on to define those deplorables as people who are racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. Ideally, the editorial board writes, even Republicans would agree that racist, sexist, and the lot are deplorable, but her comment came off as showing contempt for Trump supporters in general. Yeah, because she ascribed those characteristics to Trump supporters in general. The ad by the Latino Victory Fund, the Roanoke Times says, doesn't even have that Clinton-esque nuance. It just shows a white guy in a pickup truck and implies Gillespie supporters want to kill minority kids. The Roanoke Times says, that's a lot of Virginians right there who are being called not just homicidal, but genocidal. Indeed. Indeed. But you know what? We got to get the turnout, right? Got to make sure that our base turns out here. The best way to do that is to terrify them. Roanoke Times says, we've already said that campaign advertising is exaggerated, so we understand we're not supposed to take this ad literally. But the message is unmistakable. Republicans are bad people. That's not a good message to be sending in a democracy where come the day after the election, we're all still going to be living together and working together in a civil society. Perhaps you think Gillespie is wrong on the issues, but that doesn't make his supporters bad people. Sorry, Roanoke Times. By the time this editorial ran, we leapfrogged past Republicans are bad people, and we have reached now Republicans are evil. Roanoke Times, Republicans are bad people, says that's not a good message to be sent in a democracy.
or about Republicans are evil? Probably a little worse, wouldn't you say? Roanoke Times editorial board says this is not harmless campaign rhetoric. This is language that leads to tyranny. If Republicans really do want to run down kids, why shouldn't Democrats lock them all up? If Democrats really are criminals, communists, crackheads, and weirdos, why not herd them all into concentration camps? The Roanoke Times editorial board says, you know, here in Southwest Virginia, they say the Go Virginia Economic Development Council just produced a report that warned a declining population makes it hard to retain existing businesses in the region, much less attract new ones. Editorial board says Southwest Virginia needs new residents. Whether they come from New Jersey or New Delhi is irrelevant. Southwest Virginia needs immigration. They say that's a hard conversation to have, and this ad makes it even harder. Instead of demonizing every middle-aged white guy with a pickup truck, a rebel flag, and a Tea Party license plate, the Latino Victory Fund needs to be making the case for why immigration is actually in that guy's best interest if he wants to keep his job and collect his retirement benefits. Instead, the fund just calls him a racist. Don't be surprised if he doesn't listen to anything after that. Again, the editorial board of the Roanoke Times aren't Republicans. Not really a conservative paper. I don't know who they've endorsed for governor this year, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was Ralph Northam. But they get it. That when you, again, don't go after the candidate or the policies, but instead you try to demonize roughly 50% of the state or the nation in which you live, that does have a lasting impact after the election is over. Now, the gun control group Giffords also has a new ad in Virginia. This is a radio-only ad that is running in the Richmond area. We've got the audio of this we'll share with you as well. Again, keep in mind, this is an off-year election. There are only two states in the country that have statewide races. It's Virginia and New Jersey. You might have local elections, and I would encourage you again to get out and vote. But turnout will be very low compared to a presidential election year, like what we had last year in Virginia. So this is all about getting out the base. That's the message here in the last week of the election. Just make sure as much of the base is motivated to get out as possible. And so this is the radio ad running from the Giffords anti-gun pack in Richmond, Virginia. Take a listen.
The United States of America is the one advanced nation on earth in which we do not have sufficient common sense gun safety laws, even in the face of repeated mass killings.
President Barack Obama.
It cannot be this easy for somebody who wants to inflict harm on other people to get his or her hands on a gun.
Ralph Northam is the only candidate for governor who'll take on Donald Trump and the NRA. Northam will fight to make our communities safe and keep guns away from violent criminals. Republican Ed Gillespie cares more about his NRA endorsement than the safety of our community. Ed Gillespie will take us backwards.
Ralph Northam wants progress. He wants to take us forward, not backward.
On November 7th, get out and vote for Ralph Northam.
You can't sit this one out. It's up to you. I need you to vote.
Paid for by Giffords PAC, which is responsible for the content of this advertising.
It's interesting that they did not actually use Ralph Northam in the radio ad, right? Using Barack Obama. Also interesting, by the way, did you pick up, Cameron, the announcer mispronounced Ralph Northam's name?
No, I missed that.
And, the last time she said Ralph Northam, she said Ralph Northam.
I saw.
Whoops.
One liberal was fighting with somebody on Twitter, and she said, "Wow, I love this ad. I'm going to vote for Ralph Northern." I said, "Good. You right do that."
Okay. Now, what was the scope of that ad? Public safety, right? And Ralph Northam is going to fight for public safety, going to try to prevent violent criminals from getting their hands on guns. Now, what they didn't say in this ad, and what you wouldn't expect an anti-gun group to actually acknowledge, is that in the what we would call the Delmarva region, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., or actually D.C. Maryland, Virginia. Virginia's actually got the lowest violent crime in the region. We don't have all of the gun control laws that they have on the books in Maryland and Washington, D.C., but we have lower violent crime. Unfortunately, in Virginia, you know, violent crime has ticked up in the last couple of years under Terry McAuliffe, much like it ticked up in 2015 and 2016 under Barack Obama after, you know, years of decline. But is the issue another gun control law? Or is the issue, again, dealing with violent criminals, making sure that that there are consequences for those violent crimes, making sure that, again, those consequences, making sure that the criminals know that there will be, in fact, consequences and not a slap on the wrist. Again, it's all about turning out the base right now. So I will remind you, if you are a Virginia gun owner, first of all, make sure you're registered to vote. But secondly, this weekend, if you're out at the range, if you are in a tree stand somewhere with your buddy, have that whispered conversation. I don't want you to, you know, ruin your hunting experience, but make sure that the gun owners that you know are registered to vote, make sure that they are going to go vote next Tuesday. This is going to be a very, very important election. I think this will foreshadow in some ways the types of campaigns that we'll see in 2018. And right now, again, I think it is an absolute toss-up. Polls are all over the place in the state. It really is going to be a matter of who turns out next Tuesday. So if you are a listener, even not in Virginia, if you know any gun owners in Virginia, have that conversation with them this weekend. And if you want to volunteer, you can do so as well, no matter where you live, NRAILA.org. Click that Grassroots Division tab. You can find out more. And again, no matter where you are in the country, you can be involved in this election. All right, we're going to take a time out. When we come back, Ash Gow from Real Clear Investigations will be with us on the program. Pete Brownell, NRA president, coming up about an hour from now. Stick around. We are just getting started here on this Thursday edition of Cam and Company.
Speaking with Morgan Shields with the NRA Office of General Counsel. Morgan, welcome to the program. I'm excited to talk about the Civil Rights Defense Fund Youth Essay Contest. You guys do a lot of great work over there in the Civil Rights Defense Fund and the Office of General Counsel. I love what you do. So when I saw the opportunity to talk about this, I wanted to schedule an interview to talk about this. So tell us, what is a Youth Essay Contest?
Yeah, so the Youth Essay Contest is something the Civil Rights Defense Fund hosts every year, and it's for students from 12th grade to younger, and it gives students the opportunity to really reflect and think about how the Second Amendment affects them and what they think about the Second Amendment.
And why did you guys figure that it was important to do this?
Right, so part of the Civil Rights Defense Fund's mission is to promote education and scholarship on the Second Amendment. And part of the way we do that is by getting students and young adults to start thinking about that and producing these essays and giving them the chance to enter this contest.
That's a great idea to get them thinking at that age about the Second Amendment. And who can qualify for this? What are the age ranges in the grades?
So there's two categories. There's a senior category, which is basically high school students, so 9th grade to 12th grade. And then there's a junior category, which is 8th grade and younger. So if you can write an essay, you can enter.
And when is the deadline for this, Morgan?
The deadline is December 31st. It used to be December 1st, but we've extended the deadline to December 31st to give students the opportunity over Christmas break when they're not in school to sit down and enter the contest.
Great idea. Morgan Shields, Office of General Counsel, the Civil Rights Defense Fund Youth Essay Contest. How do we get more information?
So you can go to the CRDF's website, which is nradefensefund.org, or you can call the Office of General Counsel at 703-267-1250.
Speaking to Peter Churchborn about NRA online hunter education. Peter, welcome. Tell us, what's it all about?
So at the NRA, I'm sure a lot of you know that we do a lot of programs to help hunters in the United States. But about 3 years ago in the Hunter Services Department, we decided we wanted to do something to help the dwindling numbers of hunters getting into this industry. So As you might know, the NRA started hunter education in 1949. We were the organization that supplied all the training to new hunters for almost 22 years in the United States. So it was just natural that we got back into the business of hunter education. So for the past 3 years, we've been developing a new all-encompassing online hunter education course that we are going to give away free to every person in the United States that want to take hunter education.
Wow. Sounds like a good deal. So tell us, Peter, a little bit about the program.
Sure. So there is standards that's set by the industry of what hunter education has to be delivered in every state. Every state also has a little bit different twist on how they want it delivered in their state, but we're willing to develop anything that they need into our online course. Currently, our online course is available in Florida and soon to be coming in Oregon. We've only had it launched for 60 days, and we hope to have about seven states using our course in their state in the next 5 months.
That's awesome. Speaking with Peter Churchborn, NRA Online Hunter Education, an exciting prospect. So, Peter, this will continue to grow, and we'll continue to follow that growth with you. So how can people get more information about the program?
Sure. It's very easy. Go to www.nrahe.org. That's the landing page, and it will direct you to every state that we have and any more information that you might need.
Excellent. Peter Churchborn, NRA Online Hunter Education, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on the program.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Coming up about an hour from now, Mr. Pete Brownell, NRA president, is with us. Great music reminds me. I was listening to Sirius XM Volume earlier. They've got On Demand. You can check this out. We interviewed Charlie Daniels last week, and it was a great conversation. So they do a weekly segment on Sirius XM Volume, Anatomy of a Song, and they took a look at Charlie Daniels' Devil Went Down to Georgia. So if you want some a really interesting info about how that song came together, we talked about it a little bit with Charlie Daniels, but much more detail there at Sirius XM Volume. All right, join us from Real Clear Investigations in studio with us. Ash Gow is here. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming in. It's good to see you. And you've got a piece about Betsy DeVos, right, at
Probably.
Real Clear Investigations. Yes, you do. I'm looking at it, as a matter of fact. In Reforming Campus Justice, DeVos faces an unruly class. So this is something that has, if you're paying attention to this issue, you've seen the headlines. But I imagine if you're not paying attention to this issue, this may not have like broken through into, you know, the top tier stories. But when you see, like, Betsy DeVos can't go anywhere, it seems, without people protesting her.
Oh, she's the most hated, like next to Trump, that she is like target number one for hate in this administration. I mean, she dressed up as Miss Frizzle for Halloween and they attacked her for that because they claim she doesn't care about school children, even though she's trying to get school choice so that kids can go to better schools. But oh no, she hates children. I mean, the hate for her. I mean, if this was an Obama admin appointee, they'd be calling sexism all the day long.
And there was, I mean, I saw a story, this was probably 2 weeks ago, where she, I guess, invested in a couple of breweries here in D.C.
And what'd they say? She wants to get children drunk?
No, it was like, don't go drink beer there, right? Like, boycott these breweries because she's invested in them.
I mean, it's absolutely absurd. I mean, let's destroy small businesses now because she's given them money. I mean, that's just... just the hysteria surrounding her. I mean, it mimics everything that's going on college campuses today.
Well, and specifically, okay, so what she wants to do, and I know that this is an issue that you've been writing about for several years now, is she wants to change how sexual assault cases are handled on college campuses, making them more of what I shouldn't put words in her mouth. What does she want to do exactly? What does she want to change?
Well, she wants to make them more fair for accusers and the accused, because under the Obama administration, as you and I have discussed many times before over the years, the process was updated and schools basically got marching orders to, you know, find people responsible, mostly men. But in the process of that, you know, there was a lot of women who were still failed by the system and a lot of men who had been falsely accused. So nobody's happy with the current system under Obama. I mean, not accusers, not the accused. So Betsy DeVos wanted to fix that. But as soon as she talks about fixing it, as soon as she mentions maybe some due process for the accused, all the activists start screaming that she wants to hurt victims and survivors, right? And that this is that due process is an impediment to justice. And so she rescinds the Obama era guidance, mm-hmm. and has an interim guidance in place, which is basically just going back to 2001, 2004 guidance, which isn't giving schools anything new. They're just giving them some more flexibility right now. So they don't have to use the preponderance of evidence. They can go back to clear and convincing, which I don't think any school is going to do because the media will attack them for it.
Right.
But they have that option now, while stakeholders in the process, including survivors, falsely accused, parents, Title IX administrators, school administrators, attorneys, you know, provide comment on what a good policy and what a good process should look like. And so we don't know when we're going to get that in a year and a half from now, but something that's supposed to replace this system and be better for all parties involved, mm-hmm. is what DeVos is going for. And yet, you know, she's getting attacked because how dare you suggest that someone who's been accused might not actually be a rapist.
Well, and as you say in this column, a lot of colleges are just sticking with the Obama era guidance anyway, right? They don't, they have the option now not to, but they're just, they're in some cases, they might be worried about what the backlash would be, the mm-hmm. public backlash would be, the media backlash. But in some cases, do they really truly believe that this is the best system possible?
I don't think so, because there have been leaks of administrators that have just said, you know, we're basically told we have to do this. And kind of strung along saying that there was marching orders because their funding was threatened under Obama, that if they didn't, you know, adequately respond, which means, you know, throwing out accused students, no mm-hmm. matter what the evidence, then they could have their funding removed. And a former head of the Office for Civil Rights and Education, the Education Department, Catherine Lehman, said that wasn't an empty threat and that she had used it against schools before. So, I mean, schools are afraid. They're also afraid of the publicity, which they should be more afraid of students leaving, considering what has happened in, you know, in the free speech realm with the schools that have been most well known for that. Mizzou and Evergreen have lost students,
yeah.
right, by the truckload. So, I mean, you should be more concerned with whether students are coming to your schools.
Absolutely. You know, you raise a really interesting point, though. I mean, you say it's hard to imagine that these attitudes from these administrators will change in the wake of these sexual misconduct revelations rocking American society in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. And, you know, every day now, Ash, there are, you know, new accusations, new allegations. Brett Ratner, I guess, was the latest. He had six women come forward, you know, by name. Warner Brothers, you know, pulls the plug on a Ratner project. I think Ratner has sued one individual for libel already. You know, these things get really, really messy. But in the court of public opinion, we're not seeing a lot of companies say, well, hang on, we're going to do a thorough investigation, right? It's
right.
Okay, the accusations are made. We're cutting ties. You know, does that make it harder for colleges and universities to say, okay, listen, we're not the court of public opinion. This is a supposed violation of our policies and our laws here on campus, and so there's a process that has to be followed. Mm-hmm. Or does it increase the pressure to just, you know, take those shortcuts? The public demands action immediately. And so, you know, are these colleges kind of bending to that pressure?
I think that they will. I mean, that's what they had been basically doing this for the past few years. And now that it's completely acceptable, once again, we're in another, you know, I don't know whether these accusations against some of these people in Hollywood are true. There's, at least evidence with the Harvey Weinstein with payouts and the recordings, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of these other ones, there's no evidence. And it frightens me that we're allowed to now, if you've ever had a beef with anybody in Hollywood, right now's the time to accuse them because you could just end their career. And it's kind of frightening that there is just absolutely no questioning right now and no process and no, you know, let's get some facts before we ruin somebody's career and call them a monster. And that's how it's been on college campuses. And I think it might even get worse now because it's okay to do so. And I really, really worry about that because we're turning this idea of believe the victim, which if you're a victim, we believe you. If you're an accuser, we trust you and we're going to look into it, but we can't just destroy someone's reputation on someone else's say-so. That's not how this country works, and that's not how it should work. But that's exactly where we are right now. And it's okay in Hollywood. It's going to continue to be okay on college campuses. And that is really frightening to me.
Talking again with Ask Al from Real Clear Investigations. And, you know, I mean, that's the thing, right? So as a as an individual, you hear somebody come out and say, listen, I was sexually assaulted. You want to not only believe them, you want to, you know, help them, right?
Absolutely.
What can we do to help? But when this moves into a criminal matter, then all of a sudden there is the accused and there's the accuser. And we do live in a society where in a court of law, you're innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. And there does seem to be that block somewhere where if you say, well, those things are important, and, you know, providing help for victims of sexual assault is also important, I don't think those two things are contradictory, but we almost are in this point now where some people are saying, yeah, those two things are kind of, pick one.
Right. That's what's happened. It happened on college campuses, and now it's happening in Hollywood, that it's just due process is an impediment to justice somehow, and if you're for due process, then you're for rapists. And it's absolutely absurd, and it's damaging because, you know, as we've seen so many of the people that are being accused, or, you know, leftists that stand up with, you know, I'm a leftist, therefore nothing I do is wrong, and, you know, the trope of the male feminist who assaults people, but it's okay, you know, like Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. It's okay because he's a liberal and his policies line up, except for that one, right? Well, this is what happens when you're in a society where an accusation can just, you know, that's all that's needed, no due process, is it can come back on you. You can be accused for anything. I mean, we're starting with sex crimes. But what happens if you're saying due process is bad for that? Are you saying due process is also bad for murder or theft or like any other crime? I mean,
right.
When does it start moving into that? And, you know, I mean, people might say, oh, she's crazy. Like, it couldn't move into that. But it shouldn't be that way with sexual assault and rape. Rape is like the second most serious crime. I mean, it's up there with murder. I wouldn't say it's second. I would say it's up there with murder. But it's like it's one of those. It's like this is a really serious crime, and we're treating it like it's not.
Well, and you know, you've seen this phenomena where you're right. It's not necessarily taking the place of a court of law, but we have internet sleuths now, right? That we didn't have 10, 15 years ago. And so, anytime there's breaking news, there's a horde of people online. We're going to find out who did it. And we're going to name people who many times are not the actual suspect.
Yes.
Are not involved in any way, shape, or form with whatever crime has been committed. And yet people are outed. They are, in a sense, prosecuted, again, in that court of public opinion. And they are mm-hmm. found guilty, and they are convicted by that court of popular opinion before the facts are even known.
Right.
So it hasn't transformed into the – it hasn't made its way into the legal system yet, but – I think clearly within our society there is that impulse to immediately judge, mm-hmm. To immediately assume that all of the facts are known to us
right, and that
right
no
away.
One would lie about that.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's disappointing because particularly when you see it on a college campus, I think of – maybe I've just got an idealistic vision of what college campuses should be because to me that's where critical thinking is taught.
Was taught.
Well, okay. Right. And if you don't have that – that, to me, is the most important thing that you can learn in college. Forget the individual courses that you're taking or what you're majoring in. If you learn to think critically and rationally about things, then I think, you know, you've walked away with a beneficial college career. We don't seem to be doing that now.
No. We're being taught to assume the worst in every instance. I mean, when you have these microaggressions, right? Another thing on college campuses, which is basically like you and I are having a conversation. I say something that's not meant to be offensive, but you're offended, right? And now I'm a racist or a bigot for having said
that. I've actually been
offended
since you sat down. I've just been holding it in.
But, I know. I'm an offensive person. I mean, just – anyway. So, but some of these microaggressions that they point out are like, you know what? Why are you automatically assuming the worst in somebody and that there might not be an alternate explanation? I mean, I think one of my favorite examples is asking an Asian student to help you with math. All right, on its face, if you were just walking down campus and just saw a random Asian student and you were like, help me with math, and you have no idea whether they're taking math, maybe that's a problem. But when you're just putting out the statement, there's a possibility that maybe they are in your math class and they raise their hand a lot. And they're getting good grades and you're not, so you want a good tutor. You know, like there's never any like suggestion that there might be another explanation for someone asking or saying such a thing other than racism. It's just automatically go to bigotry right now is how you're supposed to assume everything. And I think it's really dangerous. It's that going back to not teaching you how to think critically, but teaching you what to think now.
Absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, what it leads to is not necessarily a narrowing of thinking, but a narrowing of speech and of speaking, right? We were actually, Cameron and I were talking about this before the show, because we've noticed this just over the past, I don't know, past month, two maybe, where some of the folks that we will contact say, hey, will you come on the show and talk about something? They're reluctant, not because of who we are and not because of the fact that, you know, we're NRA TV. They're worried that something that they say is going to get taken out of context and is going to get blown up and it's going to go viral and their life is going to be ruined. And so it's easier for them to just say, nah, that's okay. I don't really need the publicity. I don't really need the attention. You know, and it sucks because there are some good stories that, you know, we'll talk about, but we're not able to do that firsthand. But I get it at the same time. I totally get it because if your life can be destroyed based on, you know, nothing. In fact, there was a, I know we got to take a time out here, but there was a story a few weeks ago. It was right after the attack in Las Vegas. Maybe about a week after. And there was a coffee shop in Massachusetts. And the owner's daughter, I guess, was running social media and had posted something about, we don't want cops here. And when the owner found out, immediately took down the post, put up another one, apologizing profusely, cut the business ties with her daughter, I imagine gave her a really, stern talking to. But it was too late. Like the boycotts had already started and, you know, and it happens on the left and the right. This is something that this is a nonpartisan issue. Mm-hmm. But we do seem to be interested. It's almost a sport now, right? Who gets destroyed today?
Right. Well, Congress is so deadlocked, right? So you don't see any really big wins. So you take these tiny little wins and you feel good about yourself, like we got that person fired, or yeah, we hurt that person's business, and you think you're doing good in the world, but really you're making it worse.
Absolutely. Talking again with Ash Gow from Real Clear Investigations. Stick around. We've got more with Ash after a quick timeout. We'll be back with more right after this. I'm talking with Cole McCullough, the NRA's Director of Competitive Shooting. Cole, how are you, sir?
Hey, how are you doing, Cam? Good to see you.
It is good to see you. And tell me a little bit about what the Competitive Shooting Division is all about at NRA. I know there's some big matches that most gun owners know about, but the NRA is responsible for thousands of matches around the country every year.
Yes, sir. There's over 11,000, you know, nationwide, worldwide. So it's every different type of shooting, from small bore through action style shooting or Bianchi Cup or NRA national matches. It's far and wide.
And all across all disciplines. So how do you manage all of that? How do you even wrap your head around everything that the Competitive Shooting Division encompasses?
Well, isn't that the question? It really is. That's the thing. It's the good thing is, you know, in the past, you know, 4 or 5 months since I've been here, it gives us the chance to take a fresh look at everything. You know, from the national matches being separated instead of being all at Camp Perry, that was a very new thing for us, and it was a lot of time to get to it, and a lot of people did some great things to make it happen. But when we take a look at what is really a new shooter and what is a competitive shooter, it's not just the 18-year-old, 19-year-old junior shooter. It's somebody that's 50 or 60 saying, I can still do this stuff. And so we're trying to break down any paradigms or other stereotypes that might be on that, look at the sports that are being productive, really. You know, the transition from peacemakers helped me to see a lot of that and have some opinions. And good thing is NRA is really backing us, and we're looking forward to a great new chapter in shooting sports.
So if someone is interested in competitive shooting, but they've never actually done it, they've, you know, maybe they've gone to the range or gun owners, but they just don't know how to make that move, what's your advice?
One, be safe. And take the training, become that responsible gun-owning citizen. That is very, very important. And once you've done that or you need more appropriate training, you know, then go ahead and start in your local club matches. A lot of matches run around the United States in a variety of disciplines really have great instructors, great other shooters, good match directors, and you'll know the right ones. You'll get a good sense of feel for that and how open people are. So I'd say you start at the local levels, get your training, make sure you're safe, and then it's nothing that you can't do. I mean, it's the thing. Go have the courage to go out and have a good time. NRA is always on standby. You have some advice, give us a call. We'll help you.
And this is a really welcoming sport, by the way. I mean, I think if people are worried that, okay, you know, I'm not going to be very good, people are going to laugh, they're going to, you know, call me a newbie, that's not going to happen. I mean, you've got so many gun owners who are just excited to see a new face out there and somebody who is willing to give it a try.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, and when we talk about competitive shooting, the variety of shooting is enormous. So if you just think of an athlete, for example, you may be a soccer player, for example. That doesn't make you a great skier. Right, it's shooting sports is just like that. You may shoot rifle, it doesn't make you a great pistol shooter. For the first time this year, I didn't even have the right gun. I went to Camp Perry and I shot a big, huge boat anchor of a steel challenge gun that was a 7 inches long. I could hardly hold it on the target. But I went and shot it and I got through it and it was a great time. So was I a new shooter? No, but I was a new shooter to that. And so the thing is, you can come right out, have that courage and fun. As long as you're safe, it's not like that. It's not so competitive to the point you can't do it. It's a great thing. You'll find this whole new part of life you might be able to enjoy and have a good time regardless of your age.
Absolutely. That's another key. I mean, you talked about, you know, these new shooters are not just junior shooters. You can get into competitive shooting in your 40s, 50s, 60s, and you can be really good.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's, you know, it's the American responsible gun-owning civilian that are the dominant shooters in the world. The World Shooting Championship shows that. Where do they come from? They're niche specialists, and they train in these areas, and they set the bar time and again, time and again. Of course, there's groups like the Army Marksmanship Unit, and they have something to say about that, but they're professional trained competition shooters. The idea is that a free American gun owner, responsible gun owner, they are the ones, and a lot of people get started much later in life. So can you still be a champion? You start when you're 40 or 50? Yes, you can.
Talking again with Cole McCullough, the Director of Competitive Shooting for the National Rifle Association. So where's the best way for folks to get more information about everything that division encompasses? Are you all on the NRA's website?
Yes, we are. You can just go ahead and Google NRA Competitive Shooting Sports Division. We have a whole set of web pages. We have a Competitive Shooting Division Facebook as well, where we're constantly posting all different types of articles and YouTube videos about what's going on, how to get involved. But certainly that, you know, the NRA Competitive Shooting website and the NRA Competitive Shooting Division Facebook that's out there are great ways to get in touch with us.
Absolutely. Cole, listen, thanks again for everything that you do. Yes, and all of the volunteers and the staffers there in the competitive shooting division. This is one of the many areas of the NRA that doesn't get a lot of mainstream media focus, but it is vitally important to the future of our Second Amendment. So, Cole McCullough, thank you for spending some time with us here. Cole McCullough, director of the NRA's competitive shooting division, joining us here on Cam and Company. Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. An hour from now, Alicia Schoetz James, she is the founder of 10-4 Clothing, a new clothing line for females who carry concealed. Also, NRA President Pete Brownell joining us next hour and spending some time in studio with Ash Gow from Real Clear Investigations. And so today, Ash, we got a book excerpt from Donna Brazile. She's got a book out, I guess, in a couple of weeks called Hacked. Right. And how the DNC and the Clinton campaign was hacked and what it meant for the election. But today was all about how Donna Brazile stepped in and using her Encyclopedia Brown-like powers did an investigation and uncovered the fact that Hillary Clinton, the fix was in at the DNC. And even though Donna Brazile, who was a DNC board member, apparently, like, she knew nothing about this until she started investigating. It's crazy.
Right. She promised Bernie Sanders she was going to get to the bottom of this, and by golly, she did. She figured it out, guys. She's the hero. She was working hard this whole time, digging under every leaf, and it was all that evil Debbie Wasserman Schultz and even the Obama people. They ruined the DNC. They left them in millions in debt, and they weren't paying it back in time. And then Hillary took over, and it was just the fix was in. And I just love how Donna makes it all about her as the hero and completely leaves out that she was rigging it as well. She was giving Hillary
the debate questions,
right? And that she was a part of this whole process when she took it over. But it's just this whole, like, as if she was working against Hillary this whole time. I mean, it was very fascinating if what she says is true. But at the same time, because she made herself seem like such of a hero that was not part of the fix, it's kind of difficult to believe anything she says.
Yes.
Which maybe is also her point, to be like, I'm going to go scorched earth, but I'm going to make it so bad, like so difficult to believe because I'm leaving myself out, that no one will believe anything I say.
You know, I mean, that would be very Clinton-esque, actually, right? You know, it is funny because, as you say, I mean, like when's the next bus coming along? Okay, there you go, right? And Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you got room for you,
too. Obama, too.
Yep.
Saying Obama, like, decimated the DNC and harmed it as well. I was like, doesn't she love Obama?
She does, although, see, here's the thing. Obama's not running.
Right.
And Clinton, I think the establishment has pretty much decided... we'll blame you for your, it wasn't our fault that you didn't win. It was your fault that you didn't win, but your damaged goods too.
Mm-hmm.
The establishment wants to protect itself, obviously. And they'll work with Obama, but I think there was those gripes even during the Obama administration that, you know, what was Obama for America became Organizing for America, was siphoning off a lot of fundraising dollars that in years past would have gone to the DNC mm-hmm. or the DCCC. So I think that there were those complaints that, you know, it was all about Obama and wasn't about the party apparatus. Right.
Well, that was, I mean, I had an article last year about how nobody decimated their own party the way Obama did. I mean, Obama was only good at getting out votes for Obama. Obama was only good at fundraising for Obama. I mean, look at how many governorships, state legislatures, House seats, Senate seats that Democrats lost during Obama's 8 years and the money for the DNC, because everything was always about Obama. And Hillary could never be like that, which it was obviously, as much as the media and so many people loved Obama, was not good for the party or really, you know, the country. And, you know, Hillary could never at least have the persona that he had to make it okay with the media, right? But, I mean, this whole article today just fascinates me because it's just so many questions that definitely make you want to read her book, obviously, Donna's book. But it's these questions. It's like, what is going on that she's allowed to step out now? Like, what happened to her? Who got to her, and does it have anything to do with Podesta and the Mueller investigation?
You know, that's interesting, too, that you bring that up, right? Because we learned a couple of other things. So we finally learned how much Fusion GPS paid for that dossier, right? Mm-hmm. $168,000, apparently. This is from Ed Morrissey at Hot Air. Fusion GPS disclosing this in a statement today. $168,000 for work on a dossier. This was part of $1 million that this group Orbis, which is Christopher Steele's outfit, had received in fees and expenses from the Perkins Coie law firm, which represented the DNC in the Clinton campaign. As Ed Morrissey says, you know, so far nobody's on the record as knowing about this dossier. You know, the law firm paid $168,000 to Fusion GPS, or Fusion GPS paid $168,000 to Christopher Steele. They would then have billed Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie that would have billed the DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign for the work that was done. But nobody knows to this day how this ever got approved.
Right. Well, I mean, that kind of speaks to all, well, they have to be lying about that.
They
I
do.
Mean, like, clear,
somebody.
They do. But it speaks to, if they weren't lying, then it would speak to the disarray among Democrats. I mean, even before the Donna article today in Politico yesterday, was it the New Yorker? That had the or New York Magazine, one of those that had the article about, you know, the infighting within the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, for 8 years the media has just been pretending like it's only Republicans that fight, and that the Republican Party is so divided that it's going to just crumble, and then everything in the world will be right because Democrats will control everything, and they're wonderful and perfect and have all the answers, and they're moral, right? Even though ignoring that for 8 years, Democrats just lost and lost and lost, right, despite this fracture among Republicans. And now, you know, they're starting to write a little bit about the fracture with the Democrats because you had the Bernie wing versus the Hillary wing. Hillary was the old way
of the Democrats. And, you know, even Pelosi was somewhat more of the old way, but had been moving more and more left. The party was more lockstep left, but there was still the fracture from the Bernie wing. And now we see the extension of the Bernie wing. It's, you know, more of the Antifa type people that are attacking college campuses or, you know, any, not saying they're Bernie supporters.
No,
I'm just saying that, like, the logical extension, if the logical extension of Trump supporters and whatever people say about them would be like Charlottesville, right? Then the logical extension, you know, both ways, right?
But even within the political world, even before you get into the outliers of, you know, Antifa and the neo-Nazis, I mean, Kevin DeLeon in California is, you know, going to challenge Dianne Feinstein for her Senate seat, and he's running to her left, right? He's saying she's too moderate. She's too much of a conciliator. And we need somebody who's going to be bold, right? So he's saying that she's too wishy-washy and too squishy.
I see how that works out because I don't – like, there is no one in this country, no dumber legislator than Kevin. Like, he's the one that was on air about, like, what was it, ghost rifles?
Ghost guns.
Some, like, no idea what he's talking about. I mean, he's the reason California has the affirmative consent policy that basically says all sex is rape by default unless you have a question and answer session, which now even Governor Jerry Brown is kind of saying, well, you know, we don't know how harmful that was. We probably shouldn't do anything else to hurt due process. I mean, this guy, he doesn't know anything.
But again, that's where that split is, right?
Right.
And, you know, I'm curious, I mean, where do you think the press, quote unquote, by and large, I know that's a huge group of people, but, you know, if we can say that most of the press leans to the left, is there that same fracture you think within the media? Is there that same divide, that same civil war going on, or are they mostly lining up on one side or the other?
As far as I can tell, I don't think there's a big wing of Bernie types in the press.
Okay.
I mean, I could be wrong and there could be some outlets, but I mean, there's individuals at various outlets, but I think, you know, by and large, they're more mainstream Democrat, you know, Hillary or Obama populist wing, Obama's populism, which is even different from Bernie's populism.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems, I think, is that there's a lot of incoherence right now in politics generally, but on the left. You know, we've talked about this before. So, you know, gun control is a huge issue for Democrats right now. Mm-hmm. So is criminal justice reform. I don't know how you go about saying we need more laws on the books when you also say that the laws that we have on the books are being, systematically used to target minorities and people of color.
Right.
I don't know how you say, well, you know, we're going to fix that, but we also need more gun control laws, right? And we're going to use these new gun control laws in places like Baltimore and Chicago and Washington, D.C.
They're going to affect minorities even more.
Right, exactly. Like, those two things are at loggerheads to me, but that's something that's a contradiction that I don't think the left really wants to touch or take on.
Right. Or, well, because it's just whatever, and the right's guilty of this too. It's the policy of the day, whether it contradicts other policies, right? Like, we talk about due process, and the left used to be the due process, right? Like, if you catch someone over in Afghanistan, we want a trial for them here in America, right? And the right was like, no, Gitmo, that's fine. And now it's the right and the left are against due process, but the people who are fighting for it are a little bit more on the right, right-leaning at least. But, I mean, it's just, it's whatever, like, so when there's a shooting, gun control, full stop. When the police shoots an unarmed black man, criminal justice reform, full stop. And not realizing that, you know, both of those laws might end up contradicting each other and hurting more minorities in the future. Definitely. I mean, the reason you and I met was Shireen Allen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a gun law, and she, young black mother, she got the book thrown at her over a gun law. How's that not going to happen with other, you know, innocent minority gun owners?
Absolutely. Got the book thrown at her at the same time in the same court. Ray Rice was getting a slap on the wrist for assaulting his girlfriend. And that was one of the reasons, I think, why her story got so much attention, because you could contrast what was happening to her, right? I mean, because those stories are still going on today. I was actually talking with one of my colleagues earlier today about a guy in New Jersey, a resident of Pennsylvania, who facing 7.5 years behind bars because, again, he accidentally brought his firearm with him into New Jersey, got pulled over for, you know, traffic violation. And here's a veteran guy who, you know, law-abiding American, made a mistake, but, you know, looking at years behind bars. And, you know, maybe it goes back to, I don't know, again, that court of public opinion, right, where we want to kind of skip the real investigation process. We want to skip, sifting through the evidence carefully and looking at things. We just want
to
reach that conclusion.
And, like, understanding their story.
Right.
That these aren't dangerous people that are going somewhere to hurt someone. And yet you're looking at them as if they're just like a name on a piece of paper and just checking boxes.
You know, I mean, and listen, you're right on. That's what we should be doing. But, you know, tying this back to Virginia, State Senator Barbara Favola last night in Arlington, Virginia, on Virginia Republicans to a packed hall of Arlington Democrats. They're evil. We're the good guys.
Yeah.
Right?
If you have to tell your supporters that you're the good guys, you might not be the good guys. And, I mean, definitely just to me sounds like something the bad guys would say. I mean, like, I tweeted this out and the people, there was, I don't know, what movie, TV show that was like, you know, the guy that's, you know, in the dangerous, like, Nazi uniform is like, are we the baddies? Right?
Right.
Like, it's just like, maybe if you have to say it, you should kind of look inward.
Ashgal from Real Clear Investigations. Listen, thanks so much for hanging out with us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. We'll do it again soon. Coming up next hour, NRA President Pete Brownell, Alicia Schoch James with 10-4 Clothing and more. Stick around. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company right after this.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes, until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, and so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and then when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carrying was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low-light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check.
So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience. And I think it's great for someone that's coming in and this may be the only class they take.
Made in America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady. You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. On the program this hour, NRA President Pete Brownell on the future of hunting. Also, Alicia Schoetz-James, the founder of 10-4 Clothing, a line of clothing for female concealed carry holders. Next hour, Stan Hayes from Operation Barbecue Relief, Kurt Schlichter of Town Hall. We, of course, have all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. We were just chatting with Ash Scow from Real Clear Investigations. And I asked Ash where she thought the press, generally speaking, lined up in terms of that civil war, the split on the left, the Sandinistas versus the Clintonistas. And, you know, Ash said, I think most of them probably fall at least within the establishment, right? They're not the part of the insurgent wing of the left. I think they fall certainly on the anti-gun spectrum, right? In fact, I'm looking at a piece today from, I have to use my public radio voice, Cameron, WBUR in Boston, 90.9 at the far end of, the far left end of your dial there, WBUR in Boston, with a piece by three individuals, Megan Agnew, Associate Director of the Office of Communications and Marketing at Boston University School of Public Health, Jennifer Beard, a Clinical Associate Professor of Global Health at the Boston University School of Public Health, and Ann Donahue, an Associate Professor of Journalism at the Boston University College of Communication. And WBUR in Boston 90.9 has this piece, How to Change the Narrative on Gun Violence. So you have two individuals in the School of Public Health, one individual at the School of Communications, talking about the how to change the narrative when it comes to gun violence. And they have come to some conclusions here. They say public health and journalism needs to collaborate to change the narrative of gun violence in the United States by keeping the outrage alive. In the cases of seatbelts, smoking, and safe sex, they write, good journalism combined with public health evidence to increase knowledge, shift cultural norms, and decrease disease, injury, and death. Collaboration between the media and public health is similarly key to altering the way Americans think about gun violence, that it is a disease we can all do our part to prevent. This is how they want the news to cover firearm-related issues, with the idea that gun violence is a public health epidemic. And maybe the idea that gun ownership is a part of that public health epidemic. They write that gun violence in the United States is, in fact, an urgent public health epidemic. They say the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention define an epidemic as the occurrence of more cases of disease than expected in a given area or among a specific group of people over a particular period of time. How is it, they wonder, that we have come to expect 93 daily shooting deaths, 34,000 yearly gun deaths, 79,000 gun injuries, and a $2.8 billion outlay to treat gun violence survivors? They say the only equivocal comparison is the current opioid crisis, which is killing an estimated 175 Americans a day and is universally deemed a national crisis. Well, all right, so a couple of things here. So first of all, the gun deaths that they talk about in this country, both homicide, suicide, actually suicides, homicides, and gun accidents. Three very different categories with three very different areas that need to be addressed, wouldn't you say? Unless, again, gun ownership is that common denominator. And the way to address homicide, suicide, accidents is to address gun ownership. They also say the only equivocal comparison is the current opioid crisis, which is killing an estimated 175 Americans a day. You know, actually, there are other epidemics taking place in this country. For instance, 250,000 deaths due to medical mistakes in this country. You would think that a quarter million Americans dying because of preventable medical mistakes every year would, in fact, be a public health crisis. Would it not? And yet, these public health professionals, I don't really want to talk about it. Nope. But they do want to declare that gun violence and gun ownership is a public health epidemic. It is a disease. And it needs to be treated as a disease. So, how do they explain the fact that, again, violent crime is going down in this country for 25 years? I mean, they say, how is it that we have come to expect the number of people shot in this country? Well, I don't think we've come to expect it, but the numbers have been going down at least until 2015, which is also not noted by these public health professionals. See, it's hard to call something an epidemic when there are fewer cases of a disease occurring. And that's what we saw for 25 years here in the United States. 2015, that changed. 2016, violent crime went up again. Let's hope that these are, you know, short-term blips in a longer-term reduction in violent crime. But if you want to talk about violence or gun violence as a public health epidemic, you at least need to acknowledge what direction the numbers have been going in. And these public health professionals not only don't want to acknowledge it, they don't want you to know because it undercuts their argument. So they say, where do we start? Where do we start to try to change this narrative? First, they say, the public health community needs to collaborate with journalists to increase the visibility and relevance of gun violence research to a broad audience. Instead of avoiding journalists, as many public health professionals openly admit to doing, and painting all as unscrupulous predators, or at best, bumbling purveyors of misinformation and botched quotes, we need to reach out and strategize together about how best to tell the story of gun violence. So what about when a study comes out like Garen Winnemute's study from UC Davis out in California, taking a look at the efficacy of the universal background check laws in Washington State, Colorado, Delaware. And it shows they're really not very effective at all, as it turns out. I mean, that didn't get a whole heck of a lot of coverage. We talked about it here in this program. Do you see it mentioned anywhere else? At a time in which you've got U.S. senators introducing, quote-unquote, universal background check legislation in Congress, the media couldn't be roused to report on this new study by an anti-gun researcher that found, yeah, these laws aren't really doing what we thought that they would do. And yet, I have a feeling that the narrative that these public health professionals want to create would not include more coverage for things that that would point to the ineffectiveness of gun control laws, because that would be counter to their narrative. Their narrative isn't just, well, gun violence is a public health epidemic. Their narrative is, and the best treatment is gun control. At WBUR in Boston, they say journalism needs to develop a system of ethics when reporting on gun violence. Reporters need to minimize coverage of perpetrators to decrease copycat mass shootings. Media outlets need to not just react to gun carnage, but proactively report on successful models for prevention. Prejudices surrounding urban gun violence need to be confronted and eradicated. Guidelines for reporting on suicide offer helpful alternatives for highlighting the public health challenges of self-inflicted gun injury and death while avoiding sensationalism. Similar guidelines exist for reporting on mass shootings in a way they say that reduces the potential for contagion. Such guidelines need to be standardized across the industry. So in that ethical system of reporting on gun violence that these public health professionals and these journalists want to create, where would the armed citizen story fall? You know, we talked with Justin Pearson out in Las Vegas, Nevada earlier this week. A legal gun owner, concealed carry holder, has his firearm with him most everywhere he goes. He was at his house, heard that noise outside, opened up the door, saw this BMW tearing down the street, called 911, saw the BMW spin around, head back up the street, stop in front of a yard across the road there from where Justin was. Guy gets out, grabs this little kid, tries to start stuffing him in the car. Justin Pearson runs down the street. He's on the phone with 911 in one hand, puts his hand on his gun, says, stop. And the guy gets back in his car. The kid scoots out. He peels off. Justin's able to get the license plate. Cops are able to make an arrest. You know, that story got covered in the Las Vegas Review-Journal in a column by Victor Jakes. I don't know that there was a news story in the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I don't know that there was any local television coverage of that event, maybe after Victor Jakes' column appeared. Certainly wasn't national news that a armed citizen stopped that crime from occurring. So, again, in this system of ethics on reporting on gun violence, where is there room for the armed citizen? Because, again, if your whole narrative is, well, gun violence is a public health epidemic, and gun control is the best treatment, and we've got this system here that we've developed with public health professionals about how we're going to cover this issue, what happens when a story takes place, when an event happens that doesn't fit the narrative that has been crafted by these public health professionals and these journalists? What happens? I'm guessing that if it doesn't fit their narrative, it doesn't get covered. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's the press I know and see these days. Not going to go out of the way to report something that doesn't fit their worldview. WBUR's public health professionals say our professional missions can sometimes feel at cross purposes. Journalists report on disease and death while public health aims to prevent both. Journalists can give priority to amplifying gun violence research findings that might otherwise go unreported. And public health professionals can collaborate with journalists to develop new approaches to telling these stories of victims, families, and communities. And together, we can refocus the conversation on promising ways to identify those at risk of harming themselves or others and interrupt potentially violent situations before they escalate. By changing the narrative around this disease, they write, we can point to pragmatic, achievable solutions that will encourage activism on the local and national level. We cannot afford to do nothing. Again, the false choice of doing what they want or doing nothing. If you don't buy into what they've just tried to sell you, then you're part of the problem because you want to do nothing. It is a cheap and disingenuous way of arguing. Again, we're seeing more and more of it these days, trying to claim that moral high ground, right? They're evil. We're the good guys. I mean, that, the more I think about it, the more I will give credit to this state senator in the state of Virginia, Barbara Favola, who said, they're evil. We're the good guys. Because that really does distill probably about 90% of political conversations these days down to its essence, does it not? Well, why do you feel the way you do? Because they're evil and we're the good guys. Yeah, okay, but what you're saying, how's this going to work in the real world? Why would you even say that if you weren't evil? Why wouldn't you just accept what I, a good guy, is telling you? And if you don't accept what I, a good guy, is telling you, then you must be evil. It is an incredibly dumb way of arguing. By the way, can we see that tweet again, Cameron? I just noticed something. Now, I don't know if Anit Narapal, the Washington Post reporter who was there last night, I don't know if he snapped this picture of the crowd right as State Senator Barbara Favola was making her rousing statement. They're evil! We're the good guys! But if you notice, like, there's a guy on his phone. There are a couple of people who are just kind of looking away. Actually, there's more than one person on their phone. That must have been the moment before they all got to their feet. Looks like some of them might take a couple of moments to get to their feet there. But that does not look like a crowd that is, you know, yeah, they are evil. We are the good guys. I'm looking, by the way, at her Twitter feed. Nothing about this, by the way. Nothing. Not a, I'm sorry I called Republicans evil. Sorry. Nothing about, yeah, I stand by it. They are evil. It just didn't happen. Just, nope. 5 hours ago, retweeting Ralph Northam, or as the Giffords PAC ad calls him, Ralph Northam. Virginia fired up, ready to vote for Ralph on November the 7th. Okay. You know, listen, I don't know how this election is going to turn out. But I do know that, as Ash said, when your best argument is they're evil, you've lost the argument. You really have. If that's your go-to, well, you just have to agree with me because they're evil. That's not really persuasive. It's not really going to move the needle. I don't even know if it's going to get people out to vote, to be honest with you. You know, in fact, I'm looking at a story here. The Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation just did a new survey of millennials, asking them what they think about various figures, both in the United States and around the world. And these are historic figures as well as folks who are around today. 60% of the millennials that they surveyed had a positive view of Ronald Reagan. That's good. I think he led the list, actually. 40% had a positive view of Bernie Sanders. He was number two. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush, 39%, number three. Speaking of which, by the way, Cameron, as I was driving up here last night, I was listening to old stand-up comedy, not old, stand-up comedy from the Bush administration.
And much different, right?
Oh, it's amazing. It was amazing. It was Mike Birbiglia. And, you know, and he even says, like, I'm not really a political guy, but I'm going to make fun of Bush for like 5 minutes because it was, you know, 2006 or whatever, and you just had to do it, even if you weren't a political comic. Now, Bush, man, what a statesman he was. He was amazing. He was
now,
so
even
great.
If you are a political comic, you can't do it.
Exactly,
it's
right?
Exact opposite.
38% approval for Justin Trudeau, 37% for Angela Merkel, 31% for Donald Trump, 30% for Hillary Clinton. Man, that's got a sting for Hillary Clinton, right? I think so. 26% approval for Che Guevara. 25% approval for Vladimir Putin. 18% Karl Marx. 17% Vladimir Lenin. 16% Chairman Mao. 13% Stalin. 13% Kim Jong-un. 12% Nicolas Maduro. Oh, how the mighty Maduro has fallen. There was a day and age just a couple of years ago. Nicolas Maduro would have been right up there with Hillary Clinton, Angela Merkel, Justin Trudeau, savior of the Western world, a paving the way towards 21st century equality. I tell you what, this actually gives me a little bit of hope. The headline for this story I'm looking at from MarketWatch, Millennial Communism Sounds Pretty Chill. You know, I think that's a little clickbait headline, honestly. 60% approval for Ronald Reagan, 12% approval for Nicolas Maduro. I mean, you know, 40% approval for Bernie Sanders. Yeah, that's a little problematic. But 13% for Kim Jong-un, 16% for Mao Zedong. I don't know if millennials actually feel like communism is something great. If it was, you know, 60% approval for Chairman Mao and 16% approval for Ronald Reagan, I'd be a lot more freaked out about this poll. But it does. I don't know. Hillary Clinton at 30%, Shea at 26%. That's pretty iffy. It does suggest that perhaps there are again among not just millennials, but among Americans of all ages, a a need to learn more of our history, and to not just, you know, learn our history via tweet or YouTube video, but to actually kind of delve into who some of these folks and what their ideologies really are. According to this survey, though, despite the fact Nicolas Maduro only polls at like 12% approval, Karl Marx 18%, one in two U.S. millennials, they say, would rather live in a socialist or communist country than a capitalist democracy. One in two. Huh. Which is interesting, because I haven't heard of any mass exodus movement towards a socialist or communist country among millennials. Have you, Cameron? Has it been like some Pied Piper movement where like the Children's Crusade, the Snowflake Crusade, where they all just head off on a march down to Venezuela?
There is a tweet. Hold on, I gotta find this real quick. This was tweeted by PragerU, Dennis Prager's university, I guess it's called, online university. Half of U.S. millennials would rather live in a socialist or communist country.
Yeah.
According to that.
Yeah, I don't know where that would be, because they don't seem to be going. I guess maybe they want to turn the United States into a socialist or communist country.
Well, and how many times have you heard, well, Venezuela isn't real socialism because the West was too involved and they really couldn't do it the way they wanted to do it. There's always the socialism splaining.
Absolutely.
Venezuela. Because America intervened too much.
I think it's one of those arguments that gets repeated almost ad hominem online. True communism hasn't happened. True socialism hasn't happened yet. Okay, if that's your statement, right, that, you know, communist Russia wasn't ever really communist, it was state capitalism, and China was never really communist because it moved to state capitalism. My next question would be, then what makes you think that you would be able to achieve this when apparently it's never happened before in all of human history? Why are you the bright shining light that is going to do what Lenin couldn't do, what Mao couldn't do, what butchers like Pol Pot couldn't do? Why is it you're the special one? Why are you the savior of socialism who's going to be able to do this when it just hasn't been done? And is it more realistic for me to think, you know what, you're a nut who's not going to be able to create true socialism, than it is for me to think, my God, you are the savior of socialism. You are the chosen one. You're going to be the one to do it when nobody else could. What's easier for me and the average person to believe? That you're a crank who believes in this failed ideology, or that you alone are going to be able to do something that billions of people throughout human history have not been able to do? That tends to stop the argument, Cameron. I don't think it brings it really to a good resolution. I usually just get blocked, but...
Right. Blocked, shattered down a protest.
That's right. That's right. To the gulag with you, Cam Edwards. All right. Stick around. When we come back, Pete Brownell, NRA president, is going to join us talking about the way to stop the decline in hunting. And it might actually start with listening. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Heather Plescott with Otis Technology. Heather, what is Otis Technology? What's it all about?
Otis Technology, we manufacture gun cleaning systems and accessories. And we've kind of built our name around the breech-to-muzzle concept, where everything is being pulled through in the natural direction that the bullet travels, so you're not pushing dirt and debris back in the action.
So explain a little more what breech-to-muzzle means.
Sure. So all of our products are based on that premise, and everything includes our flexible cables, which we call our memory flex cables. So you would tie a patch or add a brush, and everything would enter in through the breech or the action area, and then it would be fed through to the muzzle and then pulled out in that direction. So you're taking all the dirt, debris, fouling that's in there while you're cleaning it is being pulled out in that direction. You're not pushing it back into the action, which can cause gums and malfunctions.
It's awesome. That makes so much sense. I love it. So give us a quick overview, a couple of the products that Otis offers.
We have a variety of cleaning systems that do everything from just one caliber to multi-caliber. So our, you know, granddaddy of them all is the Otis Elite cleaning system that cleans everything from 17 caliber to 12 gauge. It does rifle, pistol, shotguns. It's got over 60 components.
Wow.
Four brushes, cables, 100% cotton patches, slotted tips, scraper components, AP brushes. It also includes our tactical cleaning system. So it's a larger cleaning system that you can still take out with you to the range and whatnot, or leave it back where you do your cleaning back at home. But it's got a removable tactical cleaning system in it as well. And so that you can is much smaller. More compact, and you could toss that in your bag.
Wonderful.
For hunting or whatnot.
Very cool. Heather, how do you get more information about Otis Technology?
Visit our website at otistech.com.
I'm speaking with Ray Fowler with Mean Arms. What is Mean? What's it all about?
Well, Mean Arms, we're out of Woodstock, Georgia, and we're injection molders by profession. We love guns and coming up with solutions, so we've got a lot of smart folks, engineers in-house, and we came up with a better way to load an AR-15, if you can believe that.
I just love people who are in other industries that come up with cool ideas for guns because they're gun guys. You always come with the greatest stuff, so let's see what you got.
Well, this is really cool. So really, the idea was born out of California and New York, where they have the restrictions where they have to pin or fix their magazine in place. So fortunately, we're in Georgia. We don't have those restrictions yet, but we truly came up with a better way to load it. And I'm going to show you how it works here. So this is the loader. It's an MA loader. It has 10 rounds, and this is a 10-round magazine. And really, it just fits right into the ejector port. So when people come by and they see it, they're like, what exactly is that? Because it just looks so odd for it in there. But it locks into the ejector port, and it's this fast to load. So load. And then that is loaded. So,
wow.
Really, the cool part is from, you know, it goes from that to having a loaded magazine. It's just an unbelievable way to go to the range. So now,
that's,
you know, in
cool.
6 months in Georgia, I haven't taken the magazine out. I go to the range and shoot.
Oh.
And this thing doesn't have a spring. So whenever you actually load it, it's just very, it's a pleasure. I'm not pushing a thumb against the spring, and it's It truly is a better way to load an AR-15.
So where did this idea come from? How did it come about?
I would love to take credit, but actually one of the owners and one of my partners, he is a smart engineer. I fly airplanes for a living, so I'm usually the dumbest guy in the room. But these guys have come out with a great innovative way to do a lot of different things in the gun industry. So everything Mean Arms is going to be innovative. We've got some other stuff coming out. And it's just, again, we were thinking this would be for California and New York, but we're selling them in all 50 states. People just love it. And it just started this month. I mean, this is the first month we've actually had the product.
How to get more information about Mean Arms?
MeanArms.com is our website.
Thanks for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having us.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Coming up on the program in just a little bit, talking with the founder of 10-4 Clothing, Elisa Schotz-James, a new line of clothing for women who carry concealed. Right now, I want to welcome to the program the president of the National Rifle Association, Mr. Pete Brownell, is with us. Pete, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. Good to be on.
It is great talking with you, and I know a lot of folks are very excited for hunting season. Saturday kicks off deer gun season here in Virginia, and I've been spending a lunchtime this week talking with a couple of gentlemen who are down in Virginia from, I think, Michigan and Arizona, respectively. And every year they come back. It's a big family gathering. It's you know, it's the big family tradition. But
oh, yeah.
But these guys are getting older. And, you know, we had this conversation, Pete, about what's going to happen, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now. Is this still going to be that family tradition? And you write about this at America's First Freedom, the only way to stop the decline in hunting that we are seeing around the country.
Right. This article just came out in this your latest publication, the NRA annual publications, or your member publication, really talks about what's really going on out there. We as hunters, we like to tell a story. We're great conservationists, and we are. We take care of the land. We care about the animals out there. We want to make sure it's a good, healthy place to go out there and have that family experience, that good food experience. But the real battle that we have to preserve and grow the hunting culture is not putting more land out there, while that's good, the real battle is with a group of people that aren't even in hunting yet, but they're curious. They're that younger adventurer who is on the outside of our hunting culture, looking over at us, saying, what's going on over there? And we've got to stay focused on what motivates or what demotivates that group from stepping across the threshold of our church of hunting to come on in and hunt with us. So that group out there is probably the most influential group that will impact the future of hunting. And we've got to start paying attention to that non-hunter. And that's the nature of this article, was that we've got to quit talking about which one of our groups has some moral high ground on hunting. We've got to talk about collectively, mm-hmm. how do we get more people to raise their hand and say, I want to go hunting? And that's only going to take us working together as all the hunting groups, from DU to Shikar to Safari Club, Dallas Safari Club, NRA, Pheasants Forever, Sheep. I mean, all the groups out there that you and I probably all belong to, how do we all work together using our own strengths?
And so for the next year, you say that yourself, NRA First Vice President Richard Childress, you're going to be going around the country. You're going to be talking to mm-hmm. All of these pro-hunting organizations, listening and talking with these groups, right? Gathering ideas and putting together, some of the common responses and themes that you're receiving.
Right. Well, this is really groundbreaking research that Mark Duda has done, a researcher that has helped a lot of the pro-gun organizations, the hunting organizations, understand the language, the culture that we've evolved over the years. And he did a really interesting study on this non-hunting, or what we kind of fall in two camps in our own minds, or three to a degree, anti-hunters, pro-hunters, and then those that we think are apathetic. But what we find from this research is that 70% of Americans are in favor of or are interested to understand more about hunting. That's a big group, 70% mm-hmm. of Americans.
Absolutely.
We have 11 million hunters right now. 70% of America, that's a big number. So we just have to start talking to them in the language that makes sense to them. So Duda did a big research. This comes out of the efforts of the NRA Hunter Leadership Foundation that was put together under previous President Jim Porter, and carried on with Alan Coors, my predecessor, and then I'm carrying the torch here now on taking all that research and all that good effort and turning it into action so we can start turning the tide back on the number of hunters coming out and the culture of hunting.
Absolutely.
That we need to reinforce.
Well, and, you know, when you talk about, again, that huge pool of Americans out there who are interested in knowing more, and I got to tell you, I mean, from what I see online, you know, every time there's a young female hunter who posts a picture with her buck or a bear, obviously the anti-hunters come out of the woodwork. But more and more, I also see people who aren't hunters who do get this, Pete. And I've started to see pushback from people who aren't hunters who say, listen, hang on, you don't understand how hunting in Africa works, for example.
Right.
You know, and so I think the word is starting to get out that it's really easy to sort of, you know, morally preen and to try to claim that moral high ground. And, well, I'd never go hunt a giraffe, so I'm better than you. But they're not actually thinking about and maybe not are aware of what actually goes into, let's say, the hunting of a giraffe or a rhino, a legal hunt, and how that conservation really does benefit wildlife as a whole. I mean, that's a huge part of that conversation. But then, as you say, this is about emotion, right? So it's not going to all just be data, facts, and figures. It's about, on some level, what hunting provides us, the hunters, not just the communities that hunters will visit, but what do we as humans get out of hunting?
Right. If we bring that real ultra local, why do we go hunt? What allows us to go hunt? Why is the NRA involved in this? So really, let me start with why is the NRA involved in this? It, very clearly, and I'll rely back to an old saying, a right gone unexercised ceases to be a right. Many of us use our firearms out hunting. We're exercising our right for the Second Amendment. So hunting is critical to preservation of the Second Amendment, in my mind. Without firearms, we wouldn't be able to hunt. We could do some shotguns, but let me tell you, without the defense of firearms, as we've had under the NRA, we wouldn't have much of the good tools we have right now to go out and hunt. And it's just a great open space to go exercise our Second Amendment. So when I look at hunting, it comes down to access to land, legal access to enter the lands that we have, education, hunter education programs we're putting out there, and cultural defense, regardless of where you are. Every hunter cares about hunting in general, but we really care about the land that we go hunting on with our families. Down in Missouri, that family likes to have everybody come together for that one event right before Thanksgiving, for example. Go out and get a turkey. If we are starting to be restricted with nuisance laws or land restrictions or noise restrictions or got to have a sticker on your barrel that says be safe, otherwise you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. Those types of access issues are something the NRA can help out on.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm guessing that access really is perhaps the biggest barrier for those who are interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you almost feel like you got to know somebody. Right? Where do I go to get the hunter education training? The barriers to entry, particularly for somebody who maybe, let's say, lives in a city, didn't grow up in a gun running family, doesn't have that tradition of going on the family hunting trip every year. I mean, where do you even get started? It must be overwhelming for a lot of people.
It is. And every time you run into a stumbling block, it's a decision point for someone to leave that path. So the NRA is wanting to have all of our peer organizations, all the ones we mentioned before, work together on that same sheet of music to lower the barrier of discovery through education, lower the barrier of access. Where do I go hunt? Who do I go hunt with? Who's the group that's going to help me? So all those organizational structures need to be put together, because each one of us has a strength. A mentor organization or a education aspect, or we're going to help this local habitat develop. Pheasants Forever, for example, here in Iowa, is acre by acre. Every one of us has a strength. We need to be on the same sheet of paper, moving forward arm in arm, versus individually as we are right now. And that's the big push that I was writing about. And we need to focus on that non-hunter. And I kind of use this, you know, as in the church of hunting, it's not success if we say, man, I got that Baptist to come over and be a Methodist. That's not success. But yet that's how we start to react. My ethos are better than your ethos. We've got to move beyond that and go to how do we engage that non-hunter to be a hunter? We want them across the threshold. And anytime they're out there stomping around the field somewhere, building some good habitat, making it healthier for our animals out there so we can harvest them and eat them, having a better meal for our families and friends, that's success. And together we need to be working toward that.
Absolutely.
And that's the message we're going to be carrying for the next 2 to 4 to 6 and further on out years.
Talking again with NRA President Pete Brownell. Pete, listen, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the program. And if you want to do any reports from the road, check in, you know, let us know what you're hearing from folks. You just let us know. You got an open microphone.
Oh, thanks a lot. Take care, Cam.
Absolutely. You too, sir. Pete Brownell joined us, president of the National Rifle Association, on the only way to stop the decline in hunting. Make sure you check out Pete Brownell's column in the latest edition of America's First Freedom. Also, Brownell's Inc. on Twitter and brownells.com. When we come back, Alicia Schultz James of 10-4 Clothing. You can find Alicia online at 10-4clothing.com. New clothing line for women who are concealed carry holders. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company right after this.
I'm here at the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum at the Bass Pro Shop in Springfield, Missouri, with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, I'm so excited to be back out here at this beautiful museum, at this beautiful Bass Pro, the mothership. And we're out here for a special series of Curator's Corners. So, Jim, thank you for having us. And let's just jump right in, because you and I were talking a little off the air about the technology of this firearm here. Tell us what we got.
This is my favorite gun in the museum right now. I mean,
that changes from time to time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all downhill from here. How could you do that, Jim?
I wanted to be sure we did this one. This is, we call this the world's first machine gun. And that's a fairly plausible claim because what you have here is a truly ancient wheel lock. And you can see the wheel lock here. It's a little weird. You see a wheel lock here. You see another wheel lock here. You see a matchlock back here. What you have is a 16-shot gun that was made in 1580.
16 shots in 1580.
Right. A 16th century 16 shooter.
Wow. So how does it operate?
It's amazing. It uses an oval bullet that's drilled through the middle. And they are superposed loads. They're stacked one on top of the other. So you load powder ball, powder ball, powder ball, powder ball, 16 times.
Wow.
And there are a couple different ways you can load it, and we'll talk about that a little bit.
Right.
But there's a fuse material through the center of the bullet.
Okay.
So the first one fires, ignites the fuse through the bullet for the next one, and then it just keeps going 16 times if you want it to. Now, the reason there are two locks on this
right.
is you could load it with a solid bullet as your seventh bullet from the front.
Right.
And then you would have a first charge of 9 bullets all at once, and then you'd have 7 in reserve. And again, you fire the second lock, 7 of them would fire.
So you could go fully auto or sort of a...
Two full auto bursts. Or you could do your two full auto bursts, load your last one at the rear of the gun as a solid bullet, and use your matchlock for one reserve shot.
Wow.
So at this time, 1580, 1590, which is when we think this was made, this was the finest, most technical artifact that humans were making. The artistry of this is
yeah, where was
exceptional.
It made?
We believe it's a German, German wheel lock. Yeah.
The Germans love their technology.
Yeah,
they're good
do.
At it too.
They really, really do. But you know, you get to thinking about the era of the Second Amendment in America,
right?
And you get to thinking about people who sometimes say, "Well, the Second Amendment, all they knew at that time was the single shot." Muzzle-loading flintlock
right,
rifle. You had one shot, and then it was...
The technology doesn't apply to something
exactly.
fully automatic like this.
Yeah, this was a 16-shot gun from 1580. Now, this is the only one we know of that's exactly like that. But it wasn't that unusual. There were repeaters that could fire up to 30 rounds that were being used in combat as early as 1658.
Wow.
And in 1777, the Continental Congress, here in what would become the United States, passed a motion to purchase repeating flintlocks. It was designed to fire 16 to 20 rounds, just like this, superposed rounds. Continental Congress wanted to buy 100 of them. Deal fell through because the pricing was crazy. The guy wouldn't give them a straight mm-hmm. price on it. But they knew about it. They were trying to adapt it. And there were many other repeaters throughout that era, multiple barrels, rotating barrels, superposed loads, guns that had a canister of shot and a canister of powder mounted on the gun to where you could load them and repeat them. But the technology goes way, way back.
Way back.
Not common until it was perfected, but it was definitely well known.
Good to know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. Beautiful. Great start here at the Sporting Arms Museum. I'm excited, Jim. So how can we get more information about this gem of a museum and the other NRA museums?
Come see this gun and 1,000 more at the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum at Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri. And, of course, you can come see these guns at NRAMuseums.com online.
Jim Sapieca, thank you for a great start here on Curator's Corner. We'll be back with more.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Next hour, Stan Hayes with Operation Barbecue Relief. Named one of 10 CNN heroes. I know you might not be huge fans of CNN, but you're going to be a big fan of Operation Barbecue Relief after this interview, and you can help them out. We'll talk about it again with Stan Hayes next hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program the founder of 10-4 Clothing, Alicia Schultz-James, is with us on the program. Alicia, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you coming on the program. I ran across this story from WSMV in Nashville, Tennessee, about 10-4 Clothing, and I thought, man, this sounds like a really interesting company, and you sound like a really interesting person. So I appreciate you spending some time with us. Let's just start out by asking the easy question. How did you decide to start 10-4 Clothing?
Yeah, so 10-4 Clothing was based out of, honestly, frustration. I've been in law enforcement for over a decade, and so I wear a suit every day because I'm in executive service, but it didn't account for the size and weight of my firearm. A lot of women's clothing companies, they don't take into account that some women pack pistols every day. And so it was birthed out of frustration. And so we wanted to develop a product for female business concealed carry.
You know, and this is awesome because I'll be honest with you. I mean, when I'm out at gun shows and at, you know, industry events and you're looking at a lot of the tactical clothing and, you know, the industry, I think, has gotten better about designing hunting clothing for women, tactical clothing for women. But as you say, you know, we've got concealed carry purses. We've got, you know, some on the body carry options. But in terms of I can't think of ever seeing like a business suit that's designed to be worn, you know, with a concealed a firearm.
Right. Exactly. It didn't exist. And that's the thing. I got frustrated with the fact that nobody was paying attention to this cohort, if you will, of women in law enforcement. And so what I found out is that me being in the South, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, a lot of women have to dress in professional attire and also carry firearm. Now, my weapon of choice is the one I carry all the time is the Glock 22. And, you know, with it being a full size firearm, the weight and the thin material of a woman's business suit, it just didn't match up. And so we thought about it. We ripped apart everything we hated on the business suit, and then we fixed it very strategically. So we're very excited about the launch. Suits will be, the people can pre-order now, but the suits will be available in December.
That is so cool. So what has the response been so far, Alicia?
Overwhelmingly positive from the women. What I'm needing to do is really get it out in certain platforms. And, of course, we've applied to go to SHOT Show and everything. But it's a very non-traditional product. And so what I think is that, you know, trying to get it into stores where hunting and equipment is available and outfits, you know, the tactical gear. Understanding that there's a population of folks, you know, whether you go to church or you work in law enforcement or you're just a real estate agent, actually has been the population that has been calling me the most here lately. So it's really cool.
That, you know, that makes a lot of sense. Actually, we've talked with Linda Walker, who's with the Buckeye Farms Association, member of the NRA's board of directors, and she's a licensed realtor. And, you know, yes, we've had several conversations over the years about the growing number of realtors, particularly women, who are carrying. I mean, that's a dangerous job. There was a case out of Arkansas, I think this was last year, of a realtor who was actually murdered, you know, while showing a house. So that's definitely something that is on the minds of, I know, a lot of women. I'm curious, too, you know, we've got groups out there like A Girl in a Gun Club, The Well-Armed Woman, that are sort of, you know, specifically geared towards female gun owners. Have you reached out to those groups at all?
Yeah, so right now I'm just in the midst of reaching out to several different groups. Folks have contacted me really from all over. By my background being in law enforcement, obviously women want to talk about defensive tactics and, you know, other concealed carry weapons besides a firearm. And so, yeah, those folks have been reaching out in mass numbers. But I invite anyone to tweet me, call me, email me, because we're very interested in making sure that we get the product out to the people who need it most, which are concealed carry, women who conceal carry. So,
talking again with Alicia Schultz James of 10-4 Clothing at 10-4clothing.com. Now, spell that out, T-E-N-F-O-R clothing.com. And Alicia, F-O-U-R, excuse me. Sorry about that, F-O-U-R, yes. You are a firearms instructor as well, correct?
Right. Well, when I worked in the federal system, I was certified at FLETC as a firearms instructor. And so I don't do the firearms instructing day to day anymore. But yes, I worked in policing. I worked at the federal level and at the state level, all in law enforcement. So I've dedicated my career to public service. And so this is a brand new venture. But I've really thought, you know, it's a gap in the market. And women need to understand that it's okay that, you know, we want to protect ourselves. And there's not a certain type of woman, I think. A lot of women are apprehensive because they feel like, oh, I have to be a certain type of woman. And I'm like, it's for all women to feel comfortable with any type of concealed carry item.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess the certain type of woman is you need to be the type of woman who wants to be able to protect herself. That's about it, right?
That's exactly it. And that's my platform. And, you know, one thing about the brand that we talk about when we think about community involvement and law enforcement relations, because I'm in the law enforcement community and there's such a rift right now, the brand is all about having open, honest communication and trying to bridge that gap, mm-hmm. understanding that, you know, we need a society with, you know, law enforcement, and we need honest and law enforcement that have integrity. And so just trying to promote that positivity and that connection is really important to the brand.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I think you're absolutely right. And obviously, you know, you've been in law enforcement. You know this better than I do. You know, it's a collaborative effort. And that's what I think so many people don't understand. You know, in order for the police to do their jobs to the best of their ability, they're going to need the help of the community. They're going to need, you know, witness support. They're going to need people to come forward and talk about what they've seen. In order to, you know, make these neighborhoods a safer place. It doesn't necessarily always lead to testifying in open court, but you need to know that, okay, if I see something that's weird, I can go talk to that officer because I trust that officer. I trust these officers. I trust that police force.
Oh, absolutely. And that trust is major. And so with a law enforcement agency, just understanding that, you know, when we have that trust is so important, that we keep that trust, that we build upon it. But I would love to see back, you know, when the police officers used to walk down the street, and, you know, it's a whole community feel, community and police coming together. And we really promote that. We want people to feel comfortable talking to law enforcement. And that's at every level. You know, we think about police, but there are federal agents, state agencies. So at every level it's important.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it kind of sounds like you see this market not just for civilian concealed carry holders, but for law enforcement professionals who are also looking to be able to carry. Because, I mean, I got to ask, right now, if you are in that professional setting, what do you do? What are your options?
Right. For women, they're very limited. And that's the thing is you know, you can go to a smaller caliber handgun, of course, but then you lose some things there. And so it is definitely for your DEA, your FBI, your ATF agents, definitely for civilians and law enforcement. So there are not a lot of options out there. After we release in December, you know, we're go to full production. We're going to be producing a skirt, actually, that will allow for concealed carry. Now, I don't knock the purses that have the holsters inside of the purses. I just don't like to carry like that. I feel like if the crap hits the fan, I need my weapon on me to be able to address the threat. And so that's my preferred method of carry. So I'm more into designing clothing that will allow you to have your weapon on your person.
That is awesome. Well, listen, you say December, that's when this is going to be rolling out. So is that when we'll be able to, well, not me personally, but is that when people can place their orders?
Yeah, pre-orders are online now. So www.tenfourclothing.com. There's a little video on there. It's a link for pre-orders. But we have the T-shirts available for both men and women. We have the hats. Because like I said, we're creating a product to fit a need, but the brand is universal. The brand crosses gender, it crosses races, it crosses all type of demographics. So, you know, support the brand, and yeah, December is the go live date.
All right. I'm going to buy a hat this afternoon,
thank
Alicia.
You.
Look,
right,
for, look for it in the Farmville studio there. We'll put it up behind me. But listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. I wish you the very, very best, and I'd love to have you back on again in the future.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Cam.
You bet. A great talking with you. Alicia Schultz James joining us from 10-4 Clothing, 10-4clothing.com. You know, these are the ideas that work, right? The ideas when you hear something, you're like, oh, why did I think of that? Because she's right. You know, SHOT Show, NRA Show, Great American Outdoors Show, Carry Guard Expo. I've been to a lot of places just in this past year. And the amount of options as far as clothing, holsters specifically designed for women is growing exponentially. But yeah, you don't see a lot of, you don't see any sort of, you know, professional, office attire. So filling in that gap, 10-4 clothing. That's awesome. We'll check in with Alicia James, closer to, the Christmas, maybe right around, Black Friday, Cameron, you know, right? That's, be a good time to check in. Maybe in fact, well, I don't think we're going to be on the air day after Thanksgiving, but maybe we'll do like, I don't know, Mauve Monday or something, and we'll just the Monday after Black Friday. Maybe we'll just have a Second Amendment shopping extravaganza. Maybe we'll just highlight some of the good pro-Second Amendment companies out there as you are doing your Christmas shopping. All right, coming up next hour, again, Stan Hayes with Operation Barbecue Relief, Kurt Schlichter with Town Hall. Also, deal of the day, hero of the day, good guy of the day. Former NPR CEO Ken Stern still talking about his change of heart when it comes to guns. This is pretty interesting. You know, he's got a new book out now talking about his year away from the liberal bubble, living out there in the real world, doing things that he hadn't done before, like going hunting. And he has a piece at The Federalist right now, an excerpt from the book Republican Like Me. He says, gun control is a lot more complicated than more guns, more crime. And he is right. He said, I've always looked at the gun problem and assumed that there's a quote-unquote common-sense solution if the gun lobby would just get out of the way and people would just screw their heads on right. Like most Americans, he says, I still support efforts to improve the efficacy of the background check system, but I now understand them to be common sense but not solutions and potentially distractions from the core social questions of economic despair and shuttered opportunity which plague both poor minority neighborhoods and the white working class alike. He said, over the past year, I have from time to time posted the most mild-mannered of comments on Facebook, suggesting that the gun issue is more complex than one might think. My posts, he says, have been exceptionally mealy-mouthed, timid suggestions that the gun issue is tricky, or perhaps a particular National Review article is worth a look. And he says, even those mealy-mouthed suggestions have not been well-received. My liberal friends, he says, have rather disdainfully rejected the facts offered. Not usually with their own facts, but with the statement that we need to just get on with doing something, quote unquote. He says this would seem to suggest that people who don't agree with policy for window dressing sakes are somehow hunky-dory with thousands of gun deaths every year. He says it's a little lit window into the sanctimony of some liberals, and I don't like it very much. Again, Ken Stern leaving the liberal bubble and finding from a distance, oh, look at that. They think they're occupying the moral high ground, but they're really not. Huh, they're standing on the exact same level that everybody else is. How about that? Stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Dirk Grohl with NRA Store, it's the holiday season coming upon us. Let's talk about some great new stuff from NRAStore.com. What do we have for Christmas?
Well, as you said, it's the holiday season, and this first product is our limited edition holiday mug. That mug is specially made for the NRA, and we've only made 400 of those this year, and we're about halfway through. It's handmade in the USA, hand-thrown on a pottery wheel, and then it's hand-glazed with a beautiful rich red glaze. And we have a special ornament that's attached, and it has Santa and his reindeer. And on the bottom, we have NRA limited edition.
It's the first item on my list for Christmas, Dirk. Thank you. That's great.
Yeah.
So that's the
very
mug.
Popular.
What else do we have Christmas-wise? I think, what do we have, an ornament?
Our 2017 ornament. This is limited to 1,000 copies, and we're down to around 600 right now, so there's still some left.
Right.
But it's Santa's sleigh this year. That's the theme, with some greenery. It says National Rifle Association with a lot of gifts, but the most important gift in there is a rifle.
So for Christmas specifically, we have the mug and the ornament. So, but there's other new items, and you and I were talking a little before we got on the air here, and you got some really neat stuff. So show us that unique challenge coin that you have.
We made a unique challenge coin, something we've never seen before. This one is solid bronze. It's 39 millimeters. It's made in the USA. But the people that make these for us, they make these, and then they take them outside with a .223 AR-15, and they shoot a hole in them, and then they burnish the edges so you can tell all your friends, this is the size hole that a .223 makes.
So they actually, Dirk, take those out and shoot a hole in them.
It's actually shot with an actual rifle, and those little rough edges that are there, they buff those so they don't tear your pants pocket. But it's really cool, and it's $19.95.
Dude, that's a great idea. I love that. All right, what else do we have?
We have a new pistol safe. It has the NRA. Let me turn it around so you can see it. It has the NRA logo on it, and as you can see, it is
just about the right size for a full-size 1911. But this is really cool, and it's different than other pistol safes because, as you can see, it does have a push-button operation. 1,500 possible combinations, but we call it the EMP-proof pistol vault because it doesn't require any batteries, no electricity, and you can just program in any of one of those 1,500 possible four-digit combinations, and you're set if there's ever a denial of service or a power outage or, you know, some kind of catastrophic event.
Anything. So it's a, so you want to put your fully non-battery powered device. Don't put your smart gun in there, but your actual revolver or your handgun in there, and it's totally accessible, and nothing's going to keep you from getting your firearm if you need it. I love that.
Exactly, and it's got a handle on it, and you can take it with you anywhere you want to go.
That's nice. Yeah. Portable, too. An EMP-proof gun safe. I love it. And what else? I think we have one more new item. Tell us about that, Dirk.
You know when you go to the range, and you're shooting away, and it's a hot day, and all of a sudden you think, you know what I forgot? I forgot to bring bottles of water. Well, we've solved that problem with this new concealed carry cooler. This cooler will hold 12 canned beverages, and it's a really good cooler. We actually tested this. Our team took ice cubes and filled this up, and we closed it up, and 36 hours later, we still had ice cubes.
Wow.
So we know it works great. Don't forget that it has a holster and mag pouches that come with it.
Oh, it's
really nice item.
Dirk Grove, NRAstore.com. That's where you get all the info. Love the stuff. Get over there and do your holiday shopping. Thanks, Dirk, for being on the program. We'll talk to you soon.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. On the program this hour, Stan Hayes from Operation Barbecue Relief, getting it done all around the country, helping out those in need. Also, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, will be with us later on in the hour. But right now, let's get to today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, our good guy as well. We will start with our hero of the day, as always, brought to you by Adcor Defense, Shreveport, Louisiana, Shreveport Times. Four men who planned to commit a burglary last Thursday, surprised by a gun-toting homeowner, according to the Caddo Parish Sheriff's Office. According to the Sheriff's Office, just before 10 o'clock in the morning, deputies were called to Keithville, Louisiana, the 11,000 block of Peggy Lane, regarding a burglary in progress. The homeowner said several men were at her front door dressed in hoods, carrying backpacks. When she met them at the door with a handgun, the suspects fled in an SUV that had been parked in the bushes. At the same time, a passerby reported to the sheriff's office that they witnessed the hooded suspects on the porch of the residence, as well as another individual hiding in those bushes. Caddo Sheriff's Lieutenant Jackie Lewis spotted the suspect's vehicle, stopped it a short distance away. The vehicle containing several individuals, but also several backpacks, masks, a large knife, and marijuana. Sheriff's Detectives Russell Hicks, Matthew Lucky investigated the burglary, booked the suspects into the Caddo Correctional Center. 20-year-old Ja'Cory Fuller, 20-year-old Andre Ely, 20-year-old Tristan Bradley, 24-year-old Micah Eugene, all arrested for a simple burglary, possession of burglary tools, possession of marijuana. The female homeowner there in Keithville, Louisiana, who was able to stop that burglary attempt because she had a firearm on her, not facing any charges at all because she was acting in self-defense, and she is today's hero of the day. Again, like most defensive gun users around the country, trigger never pulled, presence of that firearm in the hands of the law-abiding gun owner was enough to stop that crime from proceeding any further. Now, it didn't stop a crime from taking place. All four of these individuals have been arrested and charged with various crimes, but it did stop the crime from proceeding, right? All right, deal of the day today from Alabama, AL.com, Huntsville, Alabama. A 20-year-old who pleaded guilty to murder less than 3 months ago back in jail following a weekend drug deal killing in Huntsville, Alabama, along with 21-year-old Terrion Bone, Isaiah Emery, charged in the Saturday killing of James Jones. Jones, a 26-year-old from Huntsville, found dead about 7:30 Saturday evening, apparently shot during a drug deal. Sergeant Jonathan Ware said earlier in the week the investigation revealed the shooting stemmed from a drug deal gone bad. So the two suspects arrested in this case, Terrion Bone, Isaiah Emery, Both taken to jail. Bail set at $150,000. Earlier this year, AL.com reports, Emery pleaded guilty to murder in an unrelated killing that happened in 2013. 16-year-old Robert Hewlett was killed in that fatal shooting, August 7, 2017. Isaiah Emery accepted a sentence that would keep him out of prison, pending successful completion of zero-tolerance probation. If he could avoid trouble for 5 years, Isaiah Emery would not have to serve any of a 10-year prison sentence for a murder there in Alabama. It was July 15, 2013. Hewlett and Emery found in a crashed car, both 16 years old at the time, both suffering from gunshot wounds. Hewlett and Emery were shot when they tried to rob somebody. Madison County Deputy DA said that case was also a drug deal gone wrong. Victim of the robbery shot into the teen's vehicle. They fled. Emery survived. Hewlett was pronounced dead. Although the robbery victim shot the teens, Emery charged with felony murder. Alabama law charges accomplices if their cohorts are killed during the commission of a crime. Now, the assistant DA said, I weighed the evidence. I thought about whether or not I'm going to be able to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that Emery was guilty. And I offered him a deal. He said the guilty plea was based on our evaluation of the facts and a close consultation with Mr. Hewlett's family. All those factors were taken into account. Part of the plea deal, prosecutors agreed to drop two other unrelated felony charges that Isaiah Emery faced. Charges of shooting into an occupied vehicle and first-degree robbery were dismissed. Now, here's the thing. Isaiah Emery, now behind bars, charged with another murder. But this is not the first time that he's been arrested since he got out on that first murder plea. About 2 weeks after Isaiah Emery pleaded guilty to the murder of his 16-year-old compatriot, he was arrested again, August 24th, 2017, this time on two counts of first-degree assault. But here's the thing. Those crimes, those two charges of assault, stem from an incident that happened in June of this year. That was before the plea bargain. And so the arrest didn't qualify as a probation violation. The assistant DA said he wasn't officially on probation when the actual events happened, so I don't think it would be valid grounds for revocation because it happened prior to the plea. So now that he's been charged in a second murder, Isaiah Emery will likely remain behind bars. Probation revoked. He might even have that 10-year prison sentence reinstated. But 20-year-old Isaiah Emery down there in Alabama getting some sweetheart deals along the way. He is today's deal of the day. And our good guy of the day from NPR. Yeah, I know. I kind of had the same reaction. But it's a great story. And I tell you what, tomorrow, are we talking to Tony Katz tomorrow, Cameron? I want to talk with Tony about this because this is an Indiana story. And it's really interesting. The story is about a woman named Vanessa Thompson, who is in prison for murder. Now, she actually got sentenced to prison, unlike Isaiah Emery. 1998, she was implicated along with two others in the murder of a 16-year-old in a crack cocaine-related dispute. She was convicted in 2000. She has maintained her innocence. She has also remained behind bars. NPR said during her first several years at the Indiana Women's Prison, she piled up more than two dozen misconduct tickets for disrupting the prisoner account, arguing with staff, selling her psych meds, abusing Benadryl and cough syrup. She was not a model inmate. But by 2012, NPR says she had enrolled in the prison's higher education program, and she started studying public policy. Every session, she and about a dozen other inmates looked over the fine print of bills that were before the Indiana State Legislature. They held mock committee meetings. They looked for clauses that they thought could be amended. And in 2015, she heard the now mayor of Indianapolis talking about the abandoned housing crisis in East Indianapolis. Thousands of abandoned and vacant homes. And what was the city going to do about it? And Vanessa Thompson thought, well, okay, well, what if people who were getting out of prison could help rebuild those homes? And once they had put in enough hours of construction, they would actually be eligible to live in one of these homes. Because right now, when people get out of prison, a lot of times they have a hard time finding housing. She said it is a double restoration, not just of the house, but of the person. What does Indianapolis need? A solution to this housing crisis. What do women in prison need more than anything? She said ownership of our minds, of our bodies, of our physical homes. So she wrote up this proposal. She brought it to the public policy class. They started talking about it. In April of this year, four of the inmates actually presented videotaped testimony to the state legislators. They obviously could not appear in person, so they provided videotaped testimony about this project. And the legislature unanimously approved the Constructing Our Future proposal. Yeah, unanimously. By the way, did you hear about that? Those cold-hearted, evil conservatives that run the Indiana legislature unanimously approving a idea put forth by a 44-year-old female prison inmate? Did you hear anything about that? About those heartless, evil Republicans? I sure as hell didn't. That was back in April. Found out about it in November, thanks to NPR. But, yeah, not a huge story at the time. Really, really interesting. And so now you've got this program that they're going to give it a shot. They're going to try it. The correction commissioner in Indiana, after the resolution by the legislature this spring, wrote to these inmates who put this policy together, wrote to the state representative who proposed it, congratulated them for, quote, thinking outside the four walls of the facility. He also noted that he could not guarantee that their idea would be fully implemented as they proposed it. There are some concerns among the female inmates that officials will take this idea, run with it for the state's male inmates, and perhaps not allow the female inmates to participate in this. I hope that that would not be the case. But again, a lot of good guys and gals in this story, thinking outside of the box, thinking about ways to, again, rehabilitate not just abandoned homes, but people, and to provide them that opportunity to get their life back on track once they have paid their debt to society. So there you go. To the lawmakers who unanimously approved this and to the inmates who came up with the idea, including Vanessa Thompson, thanks for being some of the good guys out there. All right, when we come back here on this program, we'll talk with Stan Hayes, a great guy and one of the many great folks involved with Operation Barbecue Relief. This is a nationwide nonprofit that has a very simple message and a very simple mission. They will go and they will feed those who need to eat in places that have been struck by natural disasters. Doesn't matter if it's a tornado, hurricane, earthquake, fires. Operation Barbecue Relief is there to feed a community in need. And now they've been named one of the top 10 CNN heroes. Now, you may not think of CNN as a heroic organization, but I tell you what, they need your votes here. And good things can happen for Operation Barbecue Relief if they get your vote. So we'll talk with Stan Hayes about that coming up in just a little bit. Stick around. There's much more Cam and Company on the way.
Speaking with Claudia Olson with NRA Youth Programs and Education and Training. Claudia, welcome to the program. We're talking about the Outstanding Achievement Youth Award presented by Brownells. Tell us, what's it all about?
Oh, it's to award youth who have participated in the shooting sports with an award. They have core requirements that they have to fulfill. They have to be at least six. They can be no older than 21. And so there are the core requirements. They have to have taken a basic firearm class. There is those who have had that prior, and their knowledge is above that. So I do accept an instructor class or a coach class, all to encourage youth to participate more, to then also play it forward. They have to participate in the marksmanship qualification program, And there's a whole list of core requirements, five in all, that they have to do. And also then they have to have at least five of the elective requirements. And there's a whole list of different NRA programs, competitions that they have to participate in to qualify.
And why is it important that NRA do this?
Well, we have to reach out to the youth and award those who are putting forth in the shooting program and giving them an award money to use it either for school to further their shooting career or if they are planning on going to a trade school. We made it an award, not a scholarship, for the purposes that the youth can decide what to spend it on.
How do we get more information about the Outstanding Achievement Youth Award?
You can visit our website and you will be able to download the form that you need to fill out and submit with your portfolio.
Talk with Jake Arnsdorf of Daniel Defense. Jake, how are you, man?
Doing good, man. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to see you. And tell me, what are you guys excited to show off? I'm looking at this Friends of the NRA 2017 Gun of the Year.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something we're very excited about. First time a black gun's been chosen as Gun of the Year. So what we have here is our Daniel Defense. It's similar to our V7 model, so it's a M-lock rail. We've got a 15-inch M-lock rail, 16-inch mid-length Cole Hammerford barrel with our superior suppression device. One unique thing about this gun is it's, this Kryptek pattern here is actually done in our proprietary Cerakote colors. So we've got our Mil-Spec Plus brown and our Tornado gray, which comprises Kryptek pattern here. So that's something we've never done before and is only available now on this gun. So.
And the only way you can get this gun is going to a Friends of the NRA dinner.
Correct, yeah. It also, one thing I forgot to mention is a two-stage Geissele trigger comes standard in all of these as well. So.
Wow. All right, so what would the estimated retail price for something like this be?
Retail price on this would probably be around $1,850. We've never actually sold these retail because they're exclusive through Friends of NRA right now, But, yeah, that's what you'd be looking at.
Okay. And, again, you know, every penny of the proceeds, if you're bidding on this gun at a Friends of NRA dinner, it all goes to the NRA Foundation. It all benefits shooting sports. And so thank you to Daniel Defense for being a part of this because, I mean, Friends of NRA dinners, this is how we raise money for, in my area, local 4-H shooting sports program, right. Our local sheriff's department. These are all benefiting from NRA Foundation grants, and it's all thanks to companies like yours.
Yeah, and we're proud to be a part of that.
Well, we're glad to have you, and again, there are plenty of Friends dinners coming up at the end of the year, so you got an opportunity to win the 2017 Friends of NRA Gun of the Year, and again, the best way to find out where your local dinner is going to be is friendsofnra.org. Make sure you find your local dinner anywhere around the country.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, SiriusXM Patriot 125 and more. Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, going to join us here in about 20 minutes or so. But right now, I want to welcome to the program from Operation Barbecue Relief, Stan Hayes is with us on the program. Stan, how are you, sir?
I am doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am good. It's good to see you at home, I think, right now, right?
Yeah, I'm at home in my home office here.
Well, congratulations on getting to spend a little time at home. And congratulations on the recognition by CNN. Operation Barbecue Relief named one of the top 10 CNN heroes today. And if folks go to CNNheroes.com, they can vote for Operation Barbecue Relief. And what is this? What do you stand to achieve here from the CNN Heroes nomination, Stan?
Well, I mean, the big thing is right now is obviously recognition that we're going to get from the many people that get to see the pieces and hopefully, you know, elevate the brand some more. But from the voting, they go there, click on my name or, you know, the face, and we have a chance to win $100,000 if we're the top one. So
wow.
For us, I mean, that's a huge amount of money for a small nonprofit like us, like it would be for any of the 10 that have been nominated.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, we were talking earlier in the show about where all Operation Barbecue Relief goes, and it's basically wherever you're needed. I mean, if there's a natural disaster out there, if there is a need to serve meals, it sounds like you guys have volunteers around the country And chances are, within a very short period of time, there are going to be Operation Barbecue Relief folks there. I mean, I know that you were in Texas for Hurricane Harvey, in Florida for Hurricane Irma, out in California for the wildfires at all?
Yeah, we were there for about, I think, 8 days, 7 or 8 days in Northern California, had two different locations, did, I think it was just shy of 60,000 meals during that time we were there in the two locations. So, I mean, it's been a very active August, September, and October.
Absolutely. And is this, I mean, do you have a down time of the year? I mean, once hurricane season passes and before tornado season starts, does it get a little quieter for you?
It does quiet down. And you know, this year actually has been a quiet year until August. We had only done it like 18,000 meals. You know, in early August, I was sitting there going, wow, you know, through a year where we don't have anything major. You know, should have been knocking on some wood or something at the time, because we were, I mean, you know, just sort of exploded. I mean, the country hasn't seen the kind of devastation that, you know, in succession like that in a very long time. I mean, Puerto Rico is the only place that we didn't go, and it wasn't for the lack of trying, and finding a way to be able to do it with and do it safely for us. So, that's the only one that, I mean, that happened that really, it's the first time we haven't really been able to make something happen when we wanted to. So that's the downer for us.
And when, I mean, again, this is, you say this is the first time that that's happened, and I guess that's the good side of that. But, you know, so what did you take from that? And what are some of the things that you want to do to grow Operation Barbecue Relief?
Well, obviously, you know, the biggest part of not going to Puerto Rico early on was, you know, you're 1 day of not having food or the resources or the power or, you know, of cooking food to becoming part of the problem there, and not part of the solution. So we were trying to do it from the mainland here and ship the meals in, whether it was via airlift of some sort. Some sort of a carrier, we could control things, and obviously we could also make sure food safety wise, you know, that was a huge concern, especially early on there when there, you know, you didn't have potable water. You had concerns about, you know, having enough, fuel and things to be able to, you know, even have generators going. So how we would be able to really do that. The key thing was taking what we learned down in Florida with the airlifts and basically supersizing it. That's we continue to work on maybe some partnerships that can help us with that, and also some resources to how we could move out and be able to do that. And we've met some people along the way. You know, we met some people with World Chef Kitchen. Is it World Chef Kitchen or the group that Chef Jose Andreas was working with down there that did such amazing work, that maybe that some partnerships we can build and alliances that will help us in the future.
Talking again with Stan Hayes from Operation Barbecue Relief. So, again, $100,000 at stake. If you go to CNNHeroes.com, you can actually vote 30 times a day. So this isn't even just where you can go and vote once. You can vote 10 times via email, 10 times through your Facebook, 10 times, I think, through Facebook Messenger if you've got it. Stan, I logged onto Facebook for the first time in like 5 months today just so I could vote for you. I want you to know that.
I greatly appreciate it. I really do, Cam.
And I will do it every day between now and, what, December 17th? Is that right?
Yeah. Well, December 17th is when it airs. I think I was told that it's December 12th is the last day for voting. So there'll be a period in between the voting so they can tally and, you know, ensure that the accounting, I guess, of the numbers are there. So,
all right. Well, again, if you go to CNNHeroes.com, you can also donate right there directly to Operation Barbecue Relief, which is fantastic. And I hope, Stan, that you're getting the word out among your volunteers. Put down the barbecue tongs and go vote.
Absolutely. It's been a fury of activity today. You know, every time I open up Facebook, there's all these tags and everything of people tagging me, getting the word out to our volunteers, getting the word out through our sponsors. And, you know, and we really haven't, I mean, it's just starting. Like I said, it's about 6 weeks, 5 weeks of, you know, having to push the ball forward here. And it's not an easy thing when, you know, you can vote that many times a day. That adds that layer of complication. In some ways, I almost wish you could only vote once a day.
Listen, me too, buddy. My clicker finger is going to get a little tired. But for Operation Barbecue Relief, it is worth it, man. All right, so we're going to have you on here throughout this process, if you don't mind, and as long as things stay quiet. Let's have you back on again in a couple weeks, all right?
All right. That'd be great. I appreciate it.
And next time, can we actually talk a little barbecue? Because, you know, we're coming up towards Thanksgiving. And
absolutely.
I want to get some tips from you, Stan.
Hey, we can talk some turkey, and we can talk some other things, you know, because I greatly enjoy the turkey at Thanksgiving, but I also enjoy what we can do after Thanksgiving with the leftovers and some plays. So, yeah, absolutely. Love to talk about it.
All right. Stan Hayes with Operation Barbecue Relief. Thanks so much, man. Congratulations on being named one of the 10 finalists there for the CNN Heroes, and we look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks a lot, Cam. Appreciate it.
You bet. Operation Barbecue Relief, OperationBBQRelief.org on the line, Operation or OpBBQRelief at Twitter as well. And again, these are just, I'm sure that all of the nominees for the CNN Heroes are great folks who are doing great things. But having had the opportunity to spend some time with Stan and the folks at Operation Barbecue Relief over the years to see what they do. And again, this is a, you know, there's so little overhead. It's all about helping people. And how this came together so organically after the tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri, and how this community of competitive barbecuers, you know, came together to help out. I am sure that you could talk to angry vegans who would shake their fists at the world of competitive barbecuing and what awful people they are. But again, you got a lot of folks who are doing good things, much like with the world of gun owners, right? You find a lot of anti-gun advocates shaking their fists, angry at gun owners, not knowing who these gun owners really, truly are and the work that they are doing in their communities. Well, you got that going on with Operation Barbecue Relief as well. All right, still to come, we've got Kurt Schlichter joining us, senior columnist at Town Hall. I want to go back, if we can, to this piece at the Federalist, and of course we can, because I'm the host. I get to decide. Ken Stern, the former CEO of NPR, writing at the Federalist about the change in his mindset when it came to gun control and how he started thinking about this. And over the past year, he says he's kind of hinted on social media that maybe he's had this change of heart, and he'll post these links to like a National Review piece, probably a Charles Cook piece, probably would never have posted anything from like America's First Freedom to his Facebook feed. Because he said even when we would post something from National Review saying, hey, you know, maybe take a look at this, it's worth a look. He said, my liberal friends have rather disdainfully rejected the facts offer, not usually with their own facts, but with the statement that we just need to get on with doing something. Right? So again, if you don't agree with their proposal, he says, then somehow you're okay with violent crime. You're okay with the murder of school children at Sandy Hook Elementary. You're okay with the murder of dozens of Americans in Las Vegas if you don't agree with their gun control proposals. And Ken Stern, the former CEO of NPR, says, you know, that's gross. He said, virtually all of the guns used in mass murder situations in the past decade were lawfully obtained and could have been lawfully obtained under proposed laws, such as the extension of background checks to private sales. And it's not just credible, he writes, to think that restricting private sales at places like gun shows will substantially reduce urban violence. He said the most recent, though admittedly still dated, surveys of prisoners undertaken back in the 90s indicate that only about 0.6% of guns obtained by criminals were from gun shows. Stern says, I'm not terribly impressed with surveys like this, but he says, I don't have any reason to dispute the conclusions. There are just too many lawful and unlawful ways to obtain a firearm to believe that new restrictions will make a material impact on outcomes. He said one of the key arguments for gun control is the unfavorable comparison, rather, between gun violence in the United States and in other, quote, developed countries. And Ken Stern says, yeah, you know, out of the 35 countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the United States ranks 31st in homicide rates, though we are far safer than Russia, Mexico, Brazil, a little safer than Latvia. He says, what is most disturbing is that we are not even a close 31. Our homicide rate is 10 times the rate of Japan, 3 times the rate in Canada, for instance. But he said, it's truly depressing stuff. Unless you're planning to move to England, where the writer Bill Bryson recently reported in all seriousness and with some satisfaction that you are more likely to be killed in England by walking into a wall than by being murdered. He said, England is an amazingly safe place. There were only 573 murders in all of England and Wales in 2015. Fewer than Chicago in 2017. He said, these numbers are deeply satisfying to gun control advocates. But he says it's not clear what they mean for the United States. And this is a key point. Ken Stern says, you know, gun control advocates linked the low murder rate in England to the 1997 Firearms Act, which effectively outlawed private ownership of handguns. But he says the truth is that the homicide rate in England was lower than the United States long before the Firearms Act, and it's actually increased a little bit since 1997. Same with Australia, although he doesn't get into that. He says the relationship between the number of guns and murder rates is not always very clear. He says Switzerland, for example, awash in guns, and yet the murder rate is pleasingly low. He said it's not that there's no relationship between gun availability and homicide rates, but the story of violence and the means of controlling it are far more complicated and nuanced than advocates on either side of the story would have us believe. He said, I started off this process thinking, as do many of my political co-religionists, it's an interesting phrase by Ken Stern there, that reducing gun violence is simply a matter of will and of overcoming the Neanderthals of the National Rifle Association. But Ken Stern says, I've learned that it's not. And if we really want to reduce gun violence, we should be focusing not first upon the weapons, but on a lot of things around it. Poverty, drugs, race, addressing mental illness, opportunity, gangs. He says, to name just a few. Again, the going after the guns is easy. Going after gun ownership is easy to say. To actually, you know, try to pass laws that would reduce the number of legal gun owners in this country would be very difficult. But if a politician needs to do something, gun control is a good thing for them to do in many places. For example, Mayor Bill de Blasio on Wednesday of this week, at a press conference updating the public on the terror attack in Manhattan on Tuesday, said there is a much bigger conversation that we could have about gun safety. Yeah. He's at a press conference talking about the terror attack where a guy claiming allegiance to ISIS from Uzbekistan used a rented pickup truck to run over people, and Bill de Blasio wants to talk gun control. Why does he want to talk truck control if he wants to talk about controlling things and banning things as opposed to dealing with individuals who are committing acts of terror or violent crime? It takes a special kind of politician to talk about a terror attack involving a truck and say, we should use this as an opportunity to talk about gun control. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, also using the occasion to praise the SAFE Act in New York State. He said, as far as gun laws, I'm increasingly proud that New York State passed some of the smartest gun laws in the country, the SAFE Act. He said, I think it's madness, the number of assault weapons that we have in this country. I think it endangers law enforcement. I think that it costs us untold numbers of deaths. There were a total in 2015, 248 homicides around the United States in which a rifle was used. 2016, there were more blunt force homicides than homicides from a rifle across the United States. Now, do you think Governor Cuomo knows that? Probably not. Do you think he would care if he did? Do you think that that would change his opinion or change his statement? Probably not. He says, I hope that one day we will have a federal policy that actually brings sanity to the gun policy laws in this country. Now, again, this was after a terrorist used a U-Haul rental truck to barrel into bicyclists and pedestrians. We need to do something about guns. That was the response by Andrew Cuomo, Bill de Blasio. Again, they don't want to talk about banning U-Haul rentals. That seems kind of silly, doesn't it? But why is it somehow less silly to say, well, we need the New York Safe Act nationwide? We were just talking about the New York Safe Act on the program this week. So in New York, with the passage of the Safe Act, you had a couple of basically three main provisions. You had the magazine ban, you had the gun ban, and then you had the background check portion of the bill. So the magazine ban was struck down by a judge, and it was replaced with a ban on magazines over 10 rounds. Originally, the ban was magazines over 7 rounds were banned. And then you could have your 10-round magazine, but you had to have a block, so you could only have 7 rounds in your magazine. All of that completely unworkable, thrown out, law changed, by the way, without the legislature actually changing the law. Governor Cuomo just decided to reinterpret it. Then you've got your semi-auto ban. I don't recall there actually, I'd have to go back and look, but if there have been any arrests and prosecutions in New York State for violating the quote-unquote assault weapons ban as part of the SAFE Act, I'm not aware of them. You know, again, I think it was the New York Times actually took a look at the number of prosecutions under the SAFE Act. And by far, the most prosecutable charge is illegal possession of a firearm. That's what's being prosecuted. By the way, that was already a crime, even before the SAFE Act. They increased the illegal possession of a firearm from a misdemeanor to a felony in New York State as part of the SAFE Act. So that's been the biggest change. Now, has it made a huge impact? Apparently it's being used quite a bit in New York City. Not being used much around the rest of the state. And I don't think that you can really point to the prosecutions, even at the federal or at the felony level, for driving a dramatic drop in violent crime in New York City or also around the Empire State. When it comes to actually enforcing these other provisions of the SAFE Act, like the magazine ban, what did we just see in Buffalo? We saw a U.S. veteran who was arrested for having 3 17-round magazines in his car, was facing 21 years in prison, and a judge said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to fully enforce this law. I'm going to give you 15 hours of community service. You're going to pay court costs. You're going to pay a $90 speeding ticket. Now go on, get out of here. Stay out of trouble, and you're good to go. That's not enforcing the SAFE Act. And again, there were no objections from gun control advocates. There was not a single anti-gun activist in New York State who was willing to go on the record to say, this is wrong. We need to treat gun violence as a public health epidemic, and that means we got to, you know, fully enforce these laws on the books. So this guy should be going to prison for 21 years. He had magazines that could hold 17 rounds. He's not allowed to have them. Why is he walking the streets? No anti-gun advocate was willing to complain about this. You know why? Because no anti-gun advocate wanted to go on the record saying that this veteran deserved to go to prison for 20 years. No anti-gun advocate wanted to be the one to say that. But do they believe it? Do they want it? If they don't really want that to happen, why would they support the SAFE Act? Because that's what the SAFE Act calls for. And if they do really think this guy should have gone to prison for 20 years for having three magazines capable of holding 17 rounds, then why wouldn't they have the courage of their convictions to speak up? You know, Governor Cuomo can make these platitudinal statements about the SAFE Act, but he didn't bring up that case either. And frankly, neither did the New York Press Corps. All right, when we come back, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, is going to join us on the program. We will return with more Kam & Company right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Dave Roden with Vertex, tell us, what is Vertex?
Man, Vertex is a brand that really focuses on the low-profile customer. So whether it's a federal customer or the civilian who's concealed carrying, we're trying to give them a low-vis alternative that doesn't scream tactical necessarily, that they can be the gray man in the crowd.
So you're trying to outfit people properly, but without having a screaming sign saying, I'm outfitted properly.
Exactly. Like, look at me, you know, or look at my Molly, look at my Velcro. Yes, sir. So, yeah, we're trying to give them options.
So how did this all come about?
So Vertex started in 2009 as a project to create a low-vis alternative pant and for a three-letter agency. And that took off and did really well. They did that in conjunction with Arc'teryx on the first design of the pant. And then they continued to roll out additional products and apparel. And then a few years ago, they got into bags. And that's really kind of catapulted the awareness of the brand.
So tell us about the bag you have there.
Yes, sir. This is the EDC Commuter Sling. It's probably the most popular bag that they make. It's a sling-style bag designed to be worn over the shoulder. A couple of great features about this. First, there's an oversized luggage tag-type handle. So in the dark, I can reach around behind myself, grab that bag, find that handle, pull it around in front of me, and then quickly pull this open and come out with whatever I need to have on the inside. A couple of nice things about this bag is that, you know, one, I can either integrate this with an existing Kydex holster, my favorite, you know, one of choice.
Yes.
Or we also make some what we call tactigami pouches, which allows them to Velcro in the holster. And it's great. It works with left-handed or right-handed, depending on how you fold it up. We have additional pouches for mags, for medic, AR, pretty much anything you would need to put into a bag. Another nice thing is we can put in ballistic panels into this bag as well.
Really?
So not only is it a concealed carry bag, but I can, you know, when I spin it around in front of me, it's in front of my A-zones, give me some core protection, or I could actually run my hand through this, what we call the Captain America feature.
Wow.
You know, overseas, there's a lot of knife attacks that are going on, and they're teaching parry techniques with your bag. So now I've got something I can actually put in my hand to defend myself and provide some ballistic protection at the same time.
Wow, that is pretty well thought out, pretty cool. And I know a couple people I know very well are going to probably want one of those. So we'll have to talk when we get off the air.
Outstanding.
Dave Roden with Vertex. You talked about the pants.
Yes, sir.
So let's talk about the pants. That's where it all started, right?
Absolutely.
For this certain three-letter agency.
So the last year we spent doing some product development meetings across the country, meeting with guys in the field and asking them what they wanted. And in short, the consistent feedback was, give me a pant that basically could be sold or would fit in at an REI, you know, an outdoor recreational store with some tactical features. So we've come out with a couple of different styles of pants, but this is the hide pant. The hide we're doing in two weights. We're doing a 7-ounce and a 5-ounce. Both of the pants have several different features that kind of help the end user. One is a pocket on the side here. When I open this up, not only do I have storage, but it's all mesh airflow on the inside. So I'm at the range on a hot day, allows airflow to get in there and cool it off. Both pants are also treated with our 375 technology, which is a climate management technology. It works with the IR of the body. In 1 yard of fabric, I have the same surface area as a football field, which helps pull heat
wow.
and moisture away from me. We also have some pockets on the sides for mags. We have a wallet trap inside of here in the back pocket, so that way it doesn't prevent your wallet from getting pickpocketed or pickpocketed. And then along the yoke, we also do an AR mag pouch as well on the left and the right side. And it's canted, so that way as I come down, I can get a positive purchase with my thumb, get that mag out of there. And then one last little feature, you know, obviously we have two-way stretch and, you know, 180 gusset for range of motion, but we do a little hidden pocket inside the cuff here. Cool. So for law enforcement, if they need a cuff key or, you know,
wow.
some Kevlar thread or something like that for an E&E situation, it gives guys some other options. And again, with the contrast stitch, it looks sharp, it's lightweight, it's breathable, and I think it's going to do well for them.
Wow, that is pretty cool. So I'm seeing a lot of thought going into this stuff. So, by the way, I'm speaking with Dave Roden of Vertex. Just quickly take us through the process when you guys sit down to develop this. You really are thinking this stuff out well.
We try to do a few different techniques. Obviously, meeting with the right people out in the field is the first step. And then we really try to tell them, you know, a couple of things. Bring in the right products that you guys like out in the field. And what we do is we can Frankenstein these things together. For example, if you like the waistband off of this pant, you like the fabric here, you like the pocket placement from this one, dude, we can do anything you want. So just tell us what you need, and we'll make it. So that way awesome. It achieves your goals out in the field.
How do we get more information about Vertex?
Simple. Just hit the website at vertex.com, V-E-R-T-X.com, and they can find the product and the gear there.
So it's Vertex, V-E-R-T-X.
Yes, sir.
.com. Dave Roden with vertex.com. Great stuff. Keep on doing what you're doing, and keep us up to speed when you got new products. We love talking to you, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be joined by our friend Jesse Jane Duff in studio for an entire hour. Also with Scott Bach with the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. NBC Philadelphia with a piece on how a New Jersey law backfired and, quote, jammed up smart gun technology. Yeah, you want to talk about some false narratives. How about the narrative put forth by gun control advocates that, you know, the only reason why we don't have smart guns is because the darn NRA and these gun owners are stopping the smart guns from being on the market. Not exactly. But we'll talk about this again with Scott Bach next hour or tomorrow on the program. Next hour, I'll probably be having a beer somewhere. Right now, Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at Town Hall, joins us on the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How about you?
You know, it's not too bad. It's early November. It feels like early fall-like here in Northern Virginia. We're 5 days away from an election in which a Virginia state senator declared every Republican is evil, Kurt. That happened last night in Arlington, Virginia.
Well, you know, I think that anybody who takes a vehicle and hunts down innocent children is evil. Of course, none of those are, you know, Gillespie supporters. None of those have "Don't Tread on Me" bumper stickers. None of them drive, you know, the pickup trucks they own.
But wait, I saw that on TV.
I know.
So it must
be
true.
This all goes back to my main point, which is they hate you. They hate you, people. Everybody who's listening to this, the elite hates you, and they fear you. They want you disarmed. They want you subservient. They want you obedient. And you refuse to be any of those things, and they hate you for it. I mean, can you think of another explanation?
You know, they – no, I mean, yeah, I can, but it still ties into they hate you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's
– it all goes back to that.
Because, you know, yeah, I mean, you could say – and I talked earlier about this is, you know, going to be a really low turnout election. It's about motivating the base. But if you're trying to motivate the base by saying Republicans are evil and we're the good guys, well, that means that you think the base hates Republicans, right?
Yes, and I think – look, I think that ad was a disaster for Northam. I think you're going to look at that and you're going to see – you look at something like that. You look at the DNC person who sent out the – said, send me resumes, but just not cisgender males. And, of course, she had her pronouns underneath
mm-hmm.
her signature block. And you see that and you realize that there's this giant swath of America and Virginia voters in particular – that these people hate.
Yes.
And I think people are going to say, wait a minute. No, I'm not going to vote for somebody who hates me.
Well, I certainly expect that. I think the big question is, will you go out and vote because you're ticked off that somebody says you're evil, right?
I think somebody will. I think, look, if you want to motivate people,
yeah.
You got to make them angry. That's what one way to do it is to make them angry. And that's what they tried to do with this truck thing. But, you know, the truck thing probably – and, you know, this woman calling, you know, her political opponents evil, I think it made the other side angry. And I think, you know – oh, yeah? Well, let me show you how this works. It's just so dumb.
Well, listen, I mean, I was reading earlier, there's an op-ed in the Roanoke Times, Southwest Virginia, and the editorial board said, look, we're not Republicans, but this was an awful ad, and here's why. And the very first reason they said is, it's false. I mean, exactly as you said, it portrays, you know, every truck driving Ed Gillespie voter as somebody who wants to, you know, run over immigrant children.
Yeah, it's such a ridiculous lie, and it's so evil.
It is, and you know, and the paper said too, like, this doesn't go after Ed Gillespie. This isn't attacking Ed Gillespie's policies or his proposals. This is attacking Virginians. Right? I mean, just like that state senator said, oh, Republicans are evil. It's not about the candidate. It's now about the voters. And as you say, they hate you. I mean, that's this is how they portray you, right?
This is what they really think. Did you see I'm here in Los Angeles. Did Northam ever get up and go, this is a disgrace? Truck driving Virginians who may not support me are still the heart and soul of this state. They are great Americans, even if they don't agree with my politics. That's their right. They've earned it by being citizens, by serving our country, by protecting their families and supporting their families. And I may not disagree. They may disagree with me. Some of them may disagree with me on policy, but I support their right to, and I don't support them being slandered by these horrible lies. And he didn't do that. Did he?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I sure didn't see it if he did.
Nope. No, not at all.
No, because he can't.
Yeah.
Because there are enough of the people who do feel that way that he doesn't dare alienate them by standing up for the truth. I frankly, I would have expected a little more of somebody who served as an Army officer. I'd expect a little more moral courage to stand up and say, no,
well,
you may not put my name on this. But, you know, he didn't do it.
No, he didn't. But, look, we had Barack Obama come to Virginia and do a fundraiser for Ralph Northam. And while Barack Obama was here in Virginia, I mean, he just excoriated Ed Gillespie for the division and the fear-mongering that the Gillespie campaign was engaged in. Since then, we've now seen this ad by the Latino Victory Fund. We've seen the comments by the state senator. And we've heard Jack Squat from the former president about the divisiveness coming from his own party in Virginia.
So, he's not against divisiveness. He's against Republicans and conservatives resisting liberal initiatives. That's what he's against. He's not, and he considers that divisive. You're dividing people away from me. Yeah, we are, because you're a bad person, because you support this kind of nonsense, or at least allow it to go on.
So again, I don't know how the election next week is going to turn out. But let's say, I'll give you two scenarios. Ed Gillespie wins. Does this change how Democrats run in 2018? Does that give Democrats an opportunity to look back and say, okay, you know what, we can't hate our way to victory?
No. This is just another, waking up in a ditch with one shoe, with your shirt covered with vomit, and it's somebody else's shirt. And the drunk says, that was just tonight, and then he goes back to drinking. Look, eventually you hit bottom. Eventually they have to come to their senses or completely marginalize themselves, because all the Democrat Party is doing right now is casting off. It's not inviting anybody in. It is casting off more and more. You can't be here unless you do this, this, and this. More and more requirements. It's growing smaller by necessity every day. It wants to, but that's dumb. And eventually, it will either go extinct or get some common sense, because they'll just lose too often. If Northam wins, I think it'll be very close. And I think they will say, yay, we won. This works. Well, it may work in a purple state like Virginia. But do you think that it'd work, one state to the south or one state to the west? I have my doubts. And so I don't expect them to take any good lessons from this. The GOP is having its own minor civil war. I think the Democrat Party is having a very big one, but we're not seeing it as much. I mean, we saw Donna Brazile today go, by the way, I preside over a giant scam. But whatever. Here's the thing. As a political party, the Democrats stopped being about what a political party should be, which is about getting its people elected.
selecting policies that generally conform with your point of view, but also getting people elected. That's the tension in any political party.
Right.
And the weight is so much on ideology now that you know the balance, the seesaw is not in equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, well, I don't care if we get elected. We all have to, you know, demand abortion through 6 months after birth. Which I think is Northam's position.
Not officially, but getting up there, getting pretty close to that. And you're right, and that's the thing. I mean, I saw, maybe it was a Harris poll today, you know, and this was looking at Congress and President Trump, and it was like 34% confidence in President Trump, 29% confidence in Democrats in Congress, 22% confidence in Republicans in Congress. Not great for anybody.
But higher than I'd expect.
But well, yeah, and you know, again, I mean, and the president still seen as more trusted than Congress, than either party in Congress. This is a problem for both Democrats and Republicans, as you say. That tension does exist, right? But if you're out there, if you're, I don't know, to me, if your goal is not to try to attract people to your party, but to try to shame people into belonging, right? Like if you're a good person.
Shame you into submission.
Exactly. I don't see that as sustainable.
It isn't. And it creates the reaction that we've seen, particularly among conservatives, particularly to the Never Trump guys. I don't know how many times I hear the, you're better than that, Kurt. You're smarter than that. You know, as if I'm supposed to go, yeah, my ideas are all wrong because they don't please you. I'd better go back to, you know, your ideas, which would have led to Hillary Clinton winning. No. I think we have figured out that shame has stopped being a useful social tool and started being weaponized against us. Because remember, Cam, shame goes one way. Shame goes one way. Shame is a tool by which we're supposed to be controlled, but the people who wield it, they are immune. They need not have no shame because they are better than us. So we quite naturally said, yeah, we're taking that off the table. Doesn't work anymore. Don't care. You're displeased with me. You're going to wag your finger at me. Oh, sad trombone. I'm voting for Trump.
It is a shame, Kurt, that music means we're out of time. Sad trombone sound when it comes time to finish our conversation with you. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir, and we'll do this again very soon.
I hope so.
All right, Kurt Schlichter joining us. We will see you tomorrow with a Friday edition of Cam and Company. Thanks for tuning in.